Good evening, Council. I want to apologize ahead of time for having to kill a tree for this handout tonight, the big long one in front of you. Let's go through this thing, page one. Questions, anytime, interrupt, feel free. Page one, some key assumptions on the budget. We're moving out that forecast of the robust recovery. We're going out to 2014. I admit I missed it. It was going to be October this year, but it ain't happening. We got a prolonged recession, and I don't see anything recovering to
2014. We're not here yet.
Yeah, for two more weeks. You know, in the past,
at the Conoco Forum, they're saying 16 to 20.
Yeah, well.
You know, the economic guy, Hart Hodges, was saying that now, at least for unemployment, it's going to be 16 or through 20.
That's from Arun Raha, and he does the state. The state is down farther than the city of Ferndale by a considerable amount. Their budget is, they're going into it, giant minuses.
Yep.
They don't have to balance.
We did put this on the website. I know that there'll be a big clamor for these, but I only brought three extra paper copies. But it's on the website. Point number two was, in the past we had some money set aside for streets and sidewalk improvements or smaller projects. There's no money in 2012 for those projects. The funding sources were solid waste and real estate excise tax.
And I haven't looked ahead, but what is it like in your five-year forecast? Is there in following years?
Let's look at the solid waste page and just check it. That's
as far as the sidewalks and road maintenance. It's zero, yeah. Zero last year, zero this year.
It's more than maintenance. It's kind of rehab or, you know, projects. Kind of like that LaBounty thing we had to do in LaBounty. But page 8 is the solid waste utility tax. And it's just not there. There's a bunch of zeros for the streets program. Similarly on real estate excise tax. I just don't see it, the funding there. So unless it really recovers.
2017, it's all zeroed out.
Yep, all the way out.
Yep.
No vehicle purchases except grant funded, and there are no known grant funded vehicles for 2012. We are getting a new vehicle this year, paid for partially from insurance proceeds, a replacement police car, but there may be more federal money for vehicles. I wouldn't hold my breath. We've purchased several police vehicles in the last 2 or 3 years from the Stone Garden federal grant.
Right.
I think that those funds are drying up. Point five, you'll see we made some progress in getting closer to balance on the general fund. Item five says the police staff only staffed to 17 officers for all of 2012. That means we're keeping one officer opening for all of 2012. To review, we have two openings right now in the police department. A third one has been kind of announced. A sergeant is leaving. So the police will certainly actively look for qualified candidates to fill those open positions. But to make this thing work, we need to keep one of those positions open for all of 2012.
Mark, on a yearly basis, how much of their salary is made up of overtime?
Well, if you're fully, if you're forced, you know, if you got no openings, I'm sure the chief would argue this. I think LEMAP said you ought to have at least 20 officers. We're budgeted at 18 right now. And this says we're budgeted at 17 officers for 2012. But if you're fully staffed, you've probably got about 5% overtime.
5%. Okay.
You know, and I think the chief would say we really would like to have two officers 24/7. We don't have that now, but we do get cooperation if that's the right word from the Sheriff Department.
Let's go back, and I don't want the council to be confused about what you just said, though, is certainly we have the openings advertised. This is coming via the police chief, who basically is having a hard time filling those positions. On the last go-round, I mean, we basically had, what, six finalists, five of them didn't pass the psych evaluation, one did, the officer that you introduced to your last meeting. And so the chief is basically fairly certain that he can fill. He's going to have probably three openings. He thinks he can probably fill two of it. It's basically coming from the police chief going, I don't think with the way the market is, with the number of police out there, City of Kirkland is kind of messing up the affair because City of Kirkland is going from sheriff's department to their own police department. So they have 51 officers that are trying to fill from the pipeline right now, and they're offering bonuses to laterals. And so the point I'm trying to make is the police chief doesn't think he'll fill all his positions because those bodies aren't there available, regardless. So it isn't that we've just said, okay, the police department can't have this. It's a police chief being realistic and going, I don't think I can fill all these positions by the time it takes to go through the system. Because we're extensive. I mean, we're one of the better departments in terms of scrutinizing our officers. So I don't think you made that clear.
That's thank you. That makes it more clear. And, you know, and if the chief mid-year next year, September next year, said, hey, I got somebody in mind, we could look at our finances, see how they are, come to you, suggest what we do there.
Mark, where in the documentation, where's the talk about the operation and maintenance of the vehicles, and is there a section to the take-home as a percentage of that total?
We don't address take-home here. We've got a fund for vehicle maintenance.
Is there a gas fund? I mean, because we've seen that go up and down over the years.
Sure. Let's jump ahead. Let's go to page 36. It's almost at the end there. This equipment repair and replacement fund is where we buy our gasoline for our vehicles and our vehicles. So we're not showing any growth in 2012, and next time I'll highlight that column for 2012.
Is that supplies?
Yeah, it would be supplies. The parts and gasoline, that sort of thing. we're not showing much growth there at all.
So the 180 for this year, 183,675. That's the number I'm looking at. And is that just police, or is that other city vehicles and shops?
183,675 would be 2010. If you go one column over,
that's last year. Okay.
172,800. We're kind of pressing that down, hoping that it will come in at that low value.
But is it divided out someplace? We know what vehicles are.
We do not. We do not get to that detail.
So is that just the police department, or is it other city administrative
All city vehicles. Yeah, for purchase of gasoline. The mechanics labor's in here, the parts, the gasoline, the outside subcontracting where we send it out and get work done. You know, that's all in here, plus the normal kind of electricity, natural gas, stuff like that. So it's a little over $400,000 a year to keep our fleet kind of running with one employee, one mechanic.
Yeah, thank you, Mark. I appreciate the mayor clarifying that because I was confused on that too. So we are having trouble staffing the police department in this economy where there are a lot of people looking for work. We're having a hard time finding.
Seems like it.
It's odd, isn't it?
Irony.
So what are things like when we got 4% unemployment? Is it still just as hard? Is that just odd right now because of this thing in Kirkland?
I find it very odd personally.
Well, perennially, if you look, police departments are always. Some police departments, when you go to their website, they have literally a opening for police officers always. It's just always. There's a lot of turnover in police agencies nationwide. It's a tough profession to not only get into but to stay in.
Sure. And then, because I read this every day, the plan action EIS, I think I read in there that we should be at 22 or 24 commissioned officers. I mean, it's like And you, I don't know if either you recall reading that in there. Currently, we should be much higher than we are.
Well, I mean, it, as a result of the planned action. Because right now, we should be at 20.
At 20, okay.
Yeah.
I thought it was a higher number ahead.
Okay. Because, yeah, but the EIS, if that, all that growth does come.
Well, this is before growth, I think.
Yeah.
I'd check on that.
So we're staffing to 17 officers plus two clerical staff for all of 2012, and that's going to help our budget. But let's turn to page 3 and look at the bottom line for the general fund. Page 4, at the bottom of the page, the 2012 column, we're underwater by only $3,438 at this point, so we're making progress to balancing this thing. A couple things changed. One was recognition of the opening for the police for all of 2012. One employee, $96,000. Fully benefited, spouse and two kids. It adds up. That's beginning salary, too. And we looked at sales tax revenue. We projected what we're going to come in at this year. We're about $20,000 higher than budget on sales tax revenues through August. We projected that into 2012, plus added $12,000 for the annexation at Grandview. So that helped a little bit. So we're really close to balancing. We're still working on it.
And that's worth repeating to me is the cost to the city of a new police officer, that's starting the cost of the city.
That's beginning 96. Salary and full 96. Benefits for a spouse and two kids.
Yeah.
$96,000. Year one. Yep. So
what's the cost without dependents, benefits on dependents?
Yeah, I don't have that number right with me.
Could you get that and break that out for me?
I will send it to you. You betcha.
A week or so.
2 weeks. I can do it tomorrow morning.
But curious with that question dangling. We couldn't advertise for a police officer that doesn't have dependents, and we're under contract to pay the expenses for the dependents based on the contract.
We couldn't discriminate based on are you single. We prefer single people. It's cheaper for us. I don't think we could do that.
No, you can't. You can't. I'd be toast. That's
yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
Don't look for a career in law enforcement.
No. I mean, once you hit four, it's four is the great thing.
At four is kind of
the
limit.
There you go.
Yeah.
Once you hit four, you're...
Everybody else is three.
Pretty much.
Monster house.
Yeah.
You're beyond that anyway.
Oh,
you're
God.
You're
not
as bad
as you're
right. And you have plenty of room.
I could borrow a few more.
Yeah. Is it our contract four, Greg?
I believe so. I was trying to remember about that. Is it three and above?
Contract we just signed with police, that's was a three-year contract?
Correct.
Yeah, the police guild. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Now, still on page 4, we're really close to balance for 2012, but we go in the red even deeper in 2013 because I added back that police opening for 2013. So I know we're not worried about 2013. We give you a six-year look ahead here, but we're getting close on 2012.
Why did 2014 we all suddenly jump up positive?
Robust recovery.
Okay.
On sales tax.
Version 3.
Oh, okay.
Sales tax comes in pretty strong. Other revenues come in strong. 2014 is a prediction.
It's crystal ball. It's pretty, yeah.
The trick is to keep pushing it out. So let's go through some of these other funds, and there's a whole bunch of them here. We'll go briefly. Page 5 is our general fund contingency reserve, and we're pretty much not much money there, about $5,000 cash balance. We can't really squeeze any more in there until 2013. Again, source is the solid waste tax. So that fund is kind of tapped until at least 2013. And most of that money went this year toward the Main Street project, part of our City Match dollars, Main Street, third to Douglas. Page 6 is our facilities cap reserve. And we're going to tap that here, I believe you approved, for the property purchase at Washington Vista. almost $93,000 for 2011. So that's, again, we don't really start growing that again until 2013, solid waste tax being the source. Our goal is $300,000 per council-approved policy.
Question on that, Mark.
Yep.
When we set up, like in 2013, $75,000 to come out of solid waste, is that just a we'd like to number, or is that a concrete number, and then we have to deal with the rest of solid waste as far as expenditure type thing?
It's not a concrete number, because we're asking you eventually here this year to adopt a 2012 budget. It's a five-year, six-year look ahead, you know, for financial planning purposes. When you look at the sales tax page, you'll see that $75,000 coming out. It all balances fund to fund, but it's financial planning. It's not a hard and fast number.
So if something comes up where we need $75,000,
yep,
then this is one of the things that may get we won't.
One of the reserve funds that would remain basically with a very small amount of money in it. And you know, a lot of these uses, if we ever get big box and get some huge sales tax, we need to think about rebuilding these reserve funds, not just spend it all. An ongoing theme. Page 7 is our LEF 1 police retiree fund. We continue to fund that, but at a kind of a reduced value for 2012. $50,000 going in there. So we currently have a balance of about $250,000 cash balance in that reserve or that retiree fund. Remember, it's three retired police officers. We have to cover their health care and basically living costs, including nursing homes, until we don't have to anymore. So it's a big liability.
In 2010, they're claims to the city were only $40,000.
Correct.
From the three of them.
All in pretty good health.
Yeah.
Yeah. We pay insurance, medical insurance on, and one of them we pay the Medicare supplement with AWC, our insurance provider, medical insurance provider. And there's some limits on annual dental costs as well. So basically, I'm assuming they'll stay pretty healthy for the next 6 years. Things can change, but we have $250,000 right now in cash balance in that fund. Page 8 is the solid waste utility tax. If you recall, the rates going up to 12% of gross in 2012. We're pretty close this year, 2011, on the revenues. We're within $25,000 to $30,000, or a little under. The trend is that it's catching up with the budget line. Hopefully that trend will continue this year. So the biggest thing on this page 8, is kind of in the middle there, substantially funding the street fund to the tune of about $550,000 per year. And then it does trail off to $450,000 in the out years. Again, that fund is, you know, the gas tax came way down from where it was 4 or 5 years ago. We get a little bit of money from encroachment permits, but that's about it. It just doesn't cover our cost to maintain and keep our roads. And roads include street lights and snow removal and street sweeping and you name it, traffic control, along with roadway. There's a lot of different categories in there.
I heard there's a potential gas tax for people who live close to the border. Has this ever been discussed around here? Yeah, I was just wondering.
Repeatedly.
Mark?
Yep.
And under 2011, the $62,000, that's under the sidewalk capitals project. Is
yep.
that the money that we've already dedicated to this Malloy project? And does that include the extra fee if they run over?
Yeah, it already includes the $37,000 approved at the beginning of the year.
It does.
That's
it does.
A city match. It does include that. Plus 25 equals 62.
You put in the 25 of the.
I'm assuming you're going to pass that tonight, the $25,000. So I put it in here. I'm sorry?
$2,500.
$25,000 solid waste tax.
Confusing. The feds only exceeded $2,500.
Oh yeah, you're right. Yeah, yeah. So you know you can squeeze a little more money out of solid waste, make that sidewalk project go. Remember, we're getting $203,000 from the feds. So again, most of it is Fed grant. Got to do the city match to make it work. So this fund is primarily paying debt service on our building projects the last 2 years. You see down below there are three or four rows there of information about annual debt service. And you'll be happy to see, Council Member Mutzel, that the very last row there is debt service funding on the 2012 library bonds. Now, we haven't done them yet. This is what the debt service would be if we went for the what the city has pledged. So we're setting that money away.
I'll say that back to you. So let's say you got $52,000 in 2014.
No.
Yep.
No.
34.
34. Oh, right below it.
2014.
I was in 14.
Oh.
That would be the debt service on about what's the ring? About a million, about 800,000.
About a million. I put about a million in. That's probably a little high.
Because that seems a little low for debt service on a million.
If you look at the previous row, 2011 general obligation bonds of the police station, starting 2012, that is the actual debt service. The way we structured it, 52 grand, 54, then jumps to 81 grand. That's the way we structured it. So I just copied that structure, if you will. 2 years of kind of lower payments, and then it jumps up to almost even payments thereafter. So this is predicting what would happen if we did this thing, which is up to conjecture whether we'll do this thing next year. But we're planning to put money away in 2012 in a debt service fund.
Now, what would happen if on the money that's going to the 550 that's going to the street fund, if we just made that an even 500 to keep this from going negative, the 49,000, what would that do to the street fund? Or how does that affect that?
Probably be in trouble.
that money is committed then in the street fund? I looked at the next page, the street fund, and I was trying to figure out how that 550 played into.
Certainly on page 9, it's a big part of the revenues for 2012. 550 out of 811. And then a 3% increase over this year's estimated costs. And no other projects in 2012 for street.
Yeah, with the street fund in, on page 9, of the street fund in 2012 had an ending fund balance of 49. Yeah, if you took 50 out, naturally you'd be about 1,000 to the negative. But worse off would be 2013, because on here, 2013, you start off with 49,000 that you ended 2012 with, and up with 27. So zeroing out 2012 means that 2013 is 50,000. Yeah.
And that's the power of a six-year look ahead.
So the only expenditure, I don't see what the expenditure is in 2012, other than reoccurring expenditures, whatever that means.
That's it. What I just described, road maintenance, sidewalk maintenance, street lights, street sweeping, snow removal, all that maintenance stuff.
Well, assuming that global warming happens, we don't need to do snow removal.
Which, you don't need what? Snow removal?
Yeah, no snow removal.
It might bring more snow, it's hard to say. But so back to page 8, solid waste. We do have a cash balance predicted of $104,000, but you're right. We for the year 2012, we're at a negative 49 for the year.
And then another 32 the next year.
Yep.
Mark, who's the senior planner we're paying for in the 2020?
The senior planning function, we don't have that position filled. Yori's doing it.
So it's going to Yori's salary?
You could say that. It's going to the senior planning function, the GMA 20-year look-ahead, comp plan updates, all that stuff the senior planner supposed to do. Yori does it now, and he doesn't get any overtime.
So it's essentially going to the current expense fund.
It is.
Okay. Then we also have, this year we're not planning on sending any to the contingency reserve, whereas last year we sent 100.
Correct. You can see those openings there, those holes in 2012.
Yeah. And then 50 less to the LEAF.
Yeah.
What are we calling that?
The police, yeah.
Left.
Left one. Yeah, it's these are tough. It's tough, and we got 0% assumed on property tax increases. But yeah, we had to kind of squeeze that in terms of building our reserves. It's easier to build when things are going well financially and revenue wise. Harder when you're kind of in the midst of a big recession.
How's solid waste doing this year from last year? Wasn't it down?
Well, look, we got the rate increase from 10% to 11% this year on gross. But we are within, as I recall the graph, we're within 25,000 to 30,000 below our budget, our revenue projection through August. But, and that gap is narrowing, July, August. So hopefully we'll come right in.
It's about 5%.
$1,167,000 is our budget.
And this is the breakdown from Recomp and RDS.
Right, the two of them combined, just the two, and yep, we get a little bit of recycling from each one as well. Recycling tax at 3%.
I'd like have a breakdown of that sometime.
Well, about half each, about 50%. It's pretty even. Okay. I don't record it in the books separately, so it'd be a lot of work to break that out. They're about 50% each. So let's go to page 9, street fund. We were talking about street fund. It needs substantial help from someplace, and the place we're getting is from solid waste utility tax. Tune about $550 a year, 2012 and 13. There's no growth, no new employees, no capital projects in 2012 or on. Just kind of keeping our head above water there. A little bit of money on encroachment permits, not much. So, park mitigation, page 10. As you recall, we borrowed money on two major parks, Centennial Riverwalk. Very favorable loan from the county, 1.5% interest, 20 years. And the Griffintown Park, I call it Second Avenue here, but it's Griffintown Park, $400,000, 3.7%, 20 years. So we lay in that debt service through 2017 and beyond. Got to pay those first. If there's anything left over, and then we can talk about any new projects, but we're showing a very, very skinny cash balance here.
So where's the numbers for 2011 for the parks mitigation?
It's on page 10, okay. Park mitigation funds. Page 10, you can see the total revenues of, for 2011, total revenues projected to be at $85,000.
Okay.
And then the total expenses is $98,000 this year. And it just comprises those two debt services, two borrowings.
So, help me out here. There's no numbers anywhere along of the repayment. Are these paid off? They're not paid off, are they?
These are 20-year deals.
So, you can just carry these out for 20 years?
Councils, this return of like the skateboard park. So, right now there's no money in the skateboard thing because they credited it all back this year.
Yeah, that's just in there.
Yeah, these loans are substantial beyond 2017. Both are 20-year deals.
So you get rid of all those other little funds. Zero them all out.
I mean, two great parks, wonderful projects. Got to pay for them.
We're talking about the return of monies.
Oh, in 2010?
Yeah.
Sure.
That's why there's nothing left. They wanted to build a skateboard park. There's no money there. If I'm reading that.
Unless the revenues come in stronger than $85,000. Yeah. So I'm just going to make those debt service payments. Page 11 is a traffic mitigation fund. Kind of hoping for a shot in the arm toward the end of this year. Hopefully it'll happen in terms of some kind of big traffic mitigation funds. Most of the expenses here are two road projects, the Main Street project and the debt service on Church Road. You may recall we borrowed $750,000 for Church Road pre-construction. So right-of-way, engineering right-of-way, this and that. And we had to make those payments back to the Public Works Trust Fund over 4 years. That's a pretty big burden, $187,500 on the principal. But we do get that paid off in 2013. So right now we have about $500,000 in the Church Road Construction Fund, so we can continue with our engineering and right-of-way purchase. Hopefully, and you'll see later I'm showing we spend all that next year, the rest of it next year. There's no money for construction at this point, but we do have the pre-construction money on a loan. So, there you have it. We're even showing money in 2013 to finish up the Main Street Douglas to Church in 2013 to finish that up. Most of it's going in 2012, $300,000 for that Main Street project. Page 12 is criminal justice, and next page is local criminal justice. Just kind of a level of effort of state money. As in the past, we pass that money through and pay for police salaries in the general fund. We transfer those dollars, you can see in that long row toward the bottom, to the general current expense fund.
Mark, I apologize, but on page 11,
yep,
where it says big box in quotation mark,
yes,
anticipating some possible fees, you've
yes
included that.
I am anticipating. It's an estimate. I don't know anything more than you do.
Where's this at? Right here.
Or?
Oh, top one, column 2012.
Oh, okay, I see it.
And page 12 and 13 deal with small levels of state monies which gets passed through to pay for police operations in the general fund. Page 14 is real estate excise tax. There's two pieces, REIT 1 and REIT 2. REIT 1 being the first 1/4 of 1% on the sales price of real property, and REIT 2 would be the second 1/4 of 1%. 2012, estimating $200,000 in revenues. And again, we have some debt service coming out of here. The city hall bonds, actually, we make final payment in 2013. So that's kind of good.
How close to your $200,000 for this year of income are we?
That's assuming we continue our current trend. We have 9 months' worth of data now. 9 months of payments for real estate excise tax. The graph is way above the original budget. So we hopefully it'll finish at $200,000. We're on that line. So if it continues, $200,000. Big chunks of money going out to the debt service on the police station, library, Pioneer Pavilion, and then also the 2011 police bonds that we just did here in July, and the 2012 library bonds.
Mark, which page are you on now?
14.
Okay.
Again, assuming we do a 2012 general obligation bonds for the library, but the debt service is planned to be serviced, even if it's not required.
And what's the whole principle? If you were to do the 2012 GOP.
Yeah, it's around $1 million. I have to look at my – I'll make that note to get that to you.
$1 million.
Thank you.
Get my calculations.
$1,050,000.
Yeah. Who knows what the interest rate will be next year. I've assumed it's the same as this year.
So the money is going to the library sink fund are coming from – both the solid waste and the real estate number
yes
two.
Yes.
Okay.
Just so, those two sources.
So when I look at the numbers, I add them together, or they?
Yeah, you'll see actually that bond sinking fund.
Yeah.
Let me give you the page reference.
Thanks.
page 24. This is the Councilmember Mutchler Memorial Debt Service Fund.
There you go.
It's the library, 2012 bonds for the library, which, if it happens, here's the debt service.
Okay, so there, yeah, and that's the number I was sort of looking for as being what it would be total.
Yep, $67,000, and that was $1,270, okay. And then it jumps to $104 and stays on that higher.
I was thinking around $80, but that comes out about right then when you add them both up there.
Yeah, we just copied what we did on this borrowing of this year. We
front-end loaded by a couple of years.
Well, we what's the right term? We didn't front-end it. We rear-ended it.
And if the library is not built to about 2020, we're close to having cash on hand for our commitment.
Ooh.
Maybe 2022.
I don't think so. But
yeah.
The debt service on
$100,000 a year.
Yeah.
The debt service on $1 million, though, is about $56,000 if you level it over 20 years.
Well, he's setting aside 68 and 70 and then 105, 104, right? It starts.
Yeah. Page 24 actually has the answer I'm searching for. The debt service is $1,050,000. The value of the bonds is $1,050,000 at 3.76% 14-year bonds.
But we're making
just like 14 years.
Just like we did with the, what did we do?
Okay, police station.
Yeah, they just, it had to be $100,000 lots.
But here's the upside is that we're saving. We're not paying on interest. We're just putting money away as if it was one. The total payments would be about $1.5 million. Or something like that, once you add up all the payments. You don't pay $1 million back, you pay the interest. We're not paying the interest. And I'm looking at a situation where in about 8 years, you've got the $1 million. Mm-hmm. Not 14 years.
Who wouldn't have to issue bonds?
Oh, my God.
Pay cash. The investment interest right now is so low, it's less than 0.25% annually. Not going to gain a whole lot of interest income if these rates continue.
Fact, well, I see where John's coming from. Yeah. You will save the interest that you would have paid had you gone out for a bond issue.
Right.
Good point. So, yeah, you pay cash at $1,050,000 or plus some other.
Instead of making payments for 14 years, we may be making payments for 10 years, 8 years.
Kind of a sinking fund.
We're paying ourselves in a separate fund. Good old fund number 220. So let's go back and start these debt service funds very briefly, because they're all kind of similar. So we ended up, let's take a quick peek, though, at page 16, which is Hotel Motel. I don't show any budget right now for 2012. It has to all get approved, grants, all that stuff. We're predicting just a 3% growth in revenue. Up to $55,317. I don't go beyond 2012. We pretty much spend what we take in with a small cash balance. So that has yet to be determined. So 17 through whatever is basically debt service on existing debt. You can look at your perusal of your convenience. Page 18 is parks, land, buildings, that sort of thing, debt service. 19, LeBounty LID bond redemption debt service. 20 is our LeBounty bond guarantee fund. We have to keep a certain balance. I think it's 10% of principal owed. Page 21 is LeBounty general obligation debt service. 22 is the 2010 borrowings. Page 23 is our 2011 borrowing. And we just talked about page 24, the library, 2012 library bond sinking fund. Then I've got two construction projects, page 25A, 25B. Main Street project 25A, we have a little funding challenge here, which we're going to address with TIB on the 29th of this month, Thursday. A lot of these numbers are subject to change. We're predicting the construction costs for 2012 from Main Street to Douglas to Church at $3.251 million. We're asking for an update from Reichardt Eaton just to see what the latest numbers might look like in this bidding environment. But we still, on the lower right-hand column at the corner down there, we're short funding about $337,000. We show all the funding from the feds and the state. We show all the city match we could squeeze out of traffic mitigation, solid waste, REIT 2. And these are the known funding sources. We've got an interfund loan stuck in there for 2011, payback in 2013. But we want to show the updated version of this to the state, the TOB guys.
And this doesn't include the 1.whatever million for the pond, 1.8 million for the pond?
No, that's over in the pond over here, different fund. Yeah. All of our street projects, water pays for water, sewer pays for sewer, storm pays for storm. It may be charged there initially, but we credit it out, put it against those utility funds.
So we're looking for the TIB to help with this.
We are.
Half-third of a million. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, they've helped us out in the past. And from talking to them just verbally, they're going to wait until we bid because you don't know what you need until you bid it. But they've been very receptive up to now. So we'll just have to see what the estimates come in at.
Page 25B is the only other active street project is the Church Road. And again, Church Road, we have about $500,000 sitting in the bank ready to be spent on engineering, pre-construction, right-of-way, bid-ready effort.
I want to jump some because I think it's important for you as council to know because we spent all last week at Cobb discussing this. Is State of Washington for the longest period basically for the last 20 years has been 39th in terms of receiving funding from the gas tax. Because of the border and the Guide Meridian roundabouts, we jumped up to where we're the 37th county in terms of receiving money. So there's 39 counties in the state of Washington. For a 20-year period, we were 39th place, last place, the last place in terms of sales tax revenue coming back to us, right, in terms of gas tax. Now, in terms of contributions, Whatcom County is number 7 now. So we're the 7th best contributing county in the state of Washington for sending gas tax to them. We're 37th for bringing it back. So if you ever want to argue with your legislature, you want to argue with people, that's a big factor that gets your dander up real quick.
Thank you. Is that a per capita number or is that an absolute number per county?
That's an absolute number. Okay. We were the 39th, now we're the 37th in terms of counties. So 39 counties was 37th in terms of money back per capita.
Per person. So we've adjusted us for the size of the counties.
Right.
That's what I mean. Okay.
So, again, page 25B deals with Church Road pre-construction costs. I don't show anything for construction. No revenues, no costs. Hopefully we'll get it bid ready and look around for opportunities revenue-wise, grant-wise. Page 26 deals with coverage ratios for our utilities, water, sewer, storm. I won't go through that in detail. You can look at that at your leisure. Coverage ratios and reserve goals, whether we meet our reserve goals or not. It's a good tool to use. We're close to meeting it. We're meeting it through 2013. Then it gets real close, and then recovers in 2017. We pay off our old sewer bonds. So, page 27, water, 28, sewer, complicated worksheets. Suffice it to say, we're on sound financial footing, water, sewer, less so in storm, but we did as much as we could do in storm. But water, sewer is good. And we'll do a water sewer rate study next year. But, you know, we have to be careful. We have to cite our comp plans for the list of capital projects and the dollars for that and the ongoing recurring costs that we have to, that has to drive rates and fees. We cannot hoard cash. If we're hoarding cash and not doing, spending our money as planned on the capital, then that's a problem. It seems like we always have a big long list of capital projects, water and sewer. we end up usually phasing them and pushing them to the right down the road. So page 29 is our debt service on our utility bonds. Page 30 is our reserve fund. We're required to keep $847,000 in our this reserve fund, and we have that money in there now. Storm, similar. Page 31 is combined storm and the storm pond construction fund.
Would you just comment on we're required to keep $800,000 in the storm fund?
In water, sewer, storm, the combined parity bond utility, we're required to keep $847,000.
That's a condition of bonding. Basically.
Absolutely.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yep. It's a complicated form, and you get three choices. Pick the lowest dollar value. This is 1.25 times the average debt service on all of our outstanding revenue parity bonds, which comprise of just water and sewer right now. If we go out with storm next year to build that pond, we'll have to add that in, see what it does in terms of our required.
So the pond is not in, that $1.8 million for the pond next year is not on here?
Let's move to page 33 for that storm pond. We set up a brand new fund number just for that storm pond and the pond debt service. So fund number 412. We show in 2013 that we grab on the revenue side $2 a month and grab that amount and settle it in right here in this fund. You recall we did increase it in 2013 $2 just to cover debt service on these 20-year bonds. So we show a regional pond, $1.984 million in 2012, borrowed $2.2 million, have to set aside some money for the reserve requirement and a cost of issuance, $50,000. And then we start making our bond debt service payments in 2013. You can see it's $176,000 per year. It's just 5% 20 years assumption. And that $2 a month that you approved for 2013 plus cost of living on top of the $2 starting in 2014 is enough to cover this bond debt service. The previous page deals only with the storm fund excluding this, and that shows the it's tight. It's really tight in 2012 on page 32. And the biggest reason it's so tight on page 32 is the 2012, we're whacking this fund $422,560 for storm costs along the roadway for Main Street between Douglas and Church. That doesn't include, I mean, that would include the, it's the storm along the roadway plus the conveyance, I believe. In there, 422. So that's a big hit for that fund. So we show a pretty small balance at the end of 2012 cash
flow. So the revenue on storm in 2013 excludes the $2?
Yeah, page 32 excludes the $2.
So the $2 is not showing up on here. It doesn't come into here and then go off to the other one.
Well, it will come in here and it will go off the other one. I'll do a transfer each month. Page 31 is grand total storm and storm construction and debt service, if you want a grand total look, page 31. But I thought it was good to break that out.
Okay.
Recurring storm and then the 412 fund, which is just the construction of the pond and debt service. And then a couple more funds, and then I'll sit down because we're about out of time. We have another debt service fund on page 34, just for utilities. Again, these numbering systems are all giving us guidance from the accounting manual from the state auditor's office. You know, debt service funds on utilities must be a 400 series. Okay, fine. So here we have it. And then 35 and 36 deal with our computer fund and our equipment automobile fund. Basically status quo. No big growth, no new stuff, just replacement of computers on page 35, about every 3 or 4 years. And similarly, page 36, no capital, no new vehicles unless it's grant covered. And I don't have any grant covered in here. Lastly, page 37 is our court agency fund. Money comes in, money goes out. Yeah, that's all I have. We'll continue to work on that general fund. Yeah, that's a good one. If we just would collect that.
Over a million.
I think it's over a million. You know, you hardly collect 10% of the fines and stuff.
Mark? 10%?
Yeah, it's pretty low.
And, you know, we,
people aren't great payment stuff.
Yeah.
Good credit risk, huh?
They said they'd be back.
Mark, are the is there anywhere in here the various individual utility revenues? Land phones, cell phones, gas, are they broken now? Is it just one big chunk?
Let me see. Page. No, I don't have those broken out, but I can.
I remember the comment about cell phone revenue is exceeding land phone revenue.
That was passed that a couple years ago.
Curiosity there.
Cell phone is definitely higher than land based phones, 6% utility tax. I can get that to you.
Oh, the internet phones, is that considered Comcast, or does Comcast break it out between data, TV, and phone service?
But they're all taxable.
Yeah, all those services would be taxable, and they would not come from Frontier, which is land-based landline phones. Used to be Verizon, now Frontier for a landline
phone. I was thinking Comcast, but I have all three of mine through Comcast, my land phone, my TV, and
we get sales tax and utility tax on cell phones and
internet phones. But did they break it up into three things or just one?
They gave us a check, $1 figure. They don't give us any detail. I've never really checked into it.
Mark, you might not know this. How about the Go phones you buy? Even you buy one and you don't.
Well,
you don't. I don't know if you throw it away, but you don't buy a plan. You're just.
That's a good question. I don't know how that would work.
I've done it. You add the minutes every whatever you do, you know.
Well, we probably get a chunk when you add the minutes. Yeah.
But they don't know where you are, though.
On the purchase, though, we get sales tax when you purchase the throwaway phones.
You do that once.
You probably don't buy them in print.
Where you buy them. Where
I bet you wherever you buy them,
that's
gets
fine, don't you?
It gets
7-Eleven.
Yeah, not here.
But the 7-Eleven sell them?
Yeah.
Really?
Hagen's has them.
They do?
Mm-hmm. I wish they did.
Instead of going down that aisle.
I bet it's the sales tax every time you recharge to the wherever you bought them from.
As you add minutes.
Okay, we're adjourned till 6 o'clock. Regular council meeting.
Then they said we have the downside too of the counties. Well, that's the idea, is when we look back from other areas, well, there wasn't a close county thing to us. So we have to do mutual aid with other cities because the closest county thing was two cities away. So, now here
would
be a different.
The GM credits, we're still
getting
those.
Still getting them. I think I showed it going.
Yeah, it ends in 14.
Yeah.
I would assume that
is that in October.
Even if not required,
we both got sick over it, so a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Those are only got like 6 weeks.
I have days that I'm kind of really good, and some days that I'm really weak. I've got a setting.
Yeah. Lean in a bad way.
Hey, Paul, you got a minute.
Setting myself up an exercise program. It probably won't be every day, but at least 3 or 4 days a week.
You gonna walk?
Yeah.
You need some of the walks?
It's helpful to have
that. Yeah, Bertone wants to walk with me, but her knees are bad. Or she has trouble with her knees. Mine is so screwed.
Yeah.
But I think I'll go do it right now.
Call the meeting to order. All please rise. To our flag. I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. You may be seated. So, clerk will now take the roll call. Councilmember Valdezzi.
Here.
Councilmember Hanson.
Here.
Okay, Council, the next up is the consent agenda.
Move to approve the.
I'd like to pull the fireworks regulation out for discussion.
Okay, so let's move fireworks to, we'll do it C2, fireworks. Okay, and then I saw Councilperson Metzler.
Same thing.
Okay. So
Move to approve the consent agenda as amended.
Second.
Okay, moved and second. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion carries 6-0. Okay, consent's gone. Now we have a presentation by an unbelievably talented person that you all should know because it's a joy that she came to Ferndale. She may be, I think we probably should hire her as a grant writer. She seems to be able to get money from all over the place. She's highly energetic. If you're ever looking for something fun to do on a Saturday morning, she's a fun person to work for, so it's my pleasure to introduce the director of the Ferndale Food Bank. That would be you.
And her name is...
Oh, I'm sorry.
Nice intro, though.
Suzanne.
Yeah. Suzanne Nevan. Mr. Jansen.
Yeah.
You know, I went home to pick up my kids and everything, and I was thinking I was going to change my clothes, and then I thought today was a distribution day. You guys need to see me battle ready, right? We lifted a lot of weight today. Thank you, Council, for letting me speak. How many minutes do I have?
How many do you want?
Well, give me a time limit because you know me.
5 minutes.
Okay. I arrived at the food bank in November of last year. It's been a real pleasure to get to know this community. I think my first comments are going to be speaking to the choir because I know all of you know what you have here, but I didn't. And I can say that if you build it, they will come. This community has responded every single time I've made an ask. I have called the big businesses and asked them to come by for a tour, and 30 minutes later, I'm getting something that I need. I had a leak in my back sink and mentioned it to some bald-headed guy, and it got fixed. I had a need for volunteers, and they arrived. So I just want to let you know that it's really a pleasure for me to live and work here. I don't live here. I live in Waltham, but not here in Ferndale. Maybe someday. little few statistics for you all that are not familiar with the food bank. Believe it or not, there are still folks that live in Ferndale that don't even know where we are. Some people that I met during the street fair this year said, we have a food bank, which means that I have a whole lot more work to do. But to let you all know, we're located in the WTA Transit Center, kind of kitty corner across the street from Texaco and McDonald's. We've been there almost 7 years. We are giving out approximately 39,000 pounds of food monthly. We are serving approximately 26,000 to 28,000 households annually. And our average family size or household size is 5.2, so that equates to approximately 130,000 individuals we're feeding. Now, if you're like me, you're going, who are these people in need? Because Ferndale doesn't seem like a place that's loaded with folks in need. About a third of our client number are folks that are senior citizens. We have quite a few folks who are working part-time jobs or being underpaid right now in this economy, and they just can't seem to make ends meet. We've seen an increase of approximately 18% in our client numbers, and folks, that's not those ne'er-do-wells, lazy folks. It's people who have lost their jobs unexpectedly in their 40s, and they're not getting hired. The stories, if I go into them, I'll lose it because I'm Italian, number one, and I'm easy prey. But the stories of these people, the shame of having to come to the food bank in the first place. And when I talk to people and say that there's need at the food bank, people don't understand that they're your neighbors. They're the people who are serving you in the grocery store. They're the people that are working in the schools. They need help. The food bank not only feeds and tries to arrest the effects of food insecurity, but I think it adds an added benefit to the community because we're alleviating some of that desperation, and that only makes this community stronger. One in six in Whatcom County suffer from food insecurity, so you all do the numbers. That's quite a few people. Okay, so enough of statistics. Why am I here today? Well, I got a lovely idea that was not my own. I stole it from King County, and it's a day of giving. So what I would like to do is have this council support the idea of having a day of giving, preferably on a Sunday, and I'm thinking the last Sunday in October, because why should we rest on our laurels? Just let's giddy up and just get this done, right, before the holiday season. So have it be a Sunday. We put out food bins all up and down Main Street in front of every business, advertise it to the community members. In churches, have envelopes on each one of the pews for folks to give, and have it be a day of giving to stop hunger. And I have two faith communities that are willing to help me orchestrate it, because something I know of this size is pretty big. The Good News community down here and the Christ the King Ferndale have offered to, in lieu of having Sunday services that day, they'll come out and help. And I just think it's a wonderful opportunity for the community to give, for the food bank to get what we need, which are those expensive canned food items. I mean, they're expensive. I would just like to get the support of the council on that. Any questions?
I think it's a good idea. What do we need to do?
Well, I have a question, too. Where are the women on this council?
In the Middle East.
Now, I just have to say, you guys, I used to work on Wall Street. I spent 4 years in New York working on Wall Street. That is the ultimate boys' club, right? But we infiltrated it something fierce. So we need to get some women on this council. Enough said. Okay. Yes?
Councilperson Hansen, you had your hand up.
Well, I was just going to move that we direct the mayor to do a proclamation making the last Sunday in October the day of giving. That will get it started, maybe.
Do I have a second for that?
Second.
Okay. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Okay.
Okay, yes.
Yeah, thank you for being here. One of your volunteers is part of my church family, and she's here tonight, Mrs. Mattson, and she has cajoled her pastor into having our congregation do a special offering and presentation in our church, and I want to thank her for being committed to the food bank, and thank you for providing such inspiring leadership to your volunteers.
All right. Thank you. I have to tell you guys, if you're not aware of this, and I guess I have to say you guys, right, until we change that up a little bit. I have to say that, do you know, we have volunteers that have been there 20-plus years. Most of the volunteers have been there in excess of 4 or 5 years. That on a weekly basis, our volunteers give 15 to 18 hours a week, unpaid, 3 distributions a week. That's phenomenal. Phenomenal. I have one woman whose husband lost her job, a Ferndale resident. She came to the food bank. She's been coming for about 4.5 months. Her husband got a job a month ago. They're finally almost back on their feet, and now she's returning as a volunteer. So we're doing good work over there. I would like to invite each one of you gentlemen to please come by. I'll give you a tour of the food bank. We welcome volunteers to come and help us on a Saturday. There's lots of different tasks that you can get involved with. And just come see what we're doing, and let's do more together. I see our community meal guy here.
I have lots of stuff for you. In
well,
boxes.
After your Saturday is done, this Saturday, come by us our anniversary dinner.
Pardon me? I couldn't hear you.
That's because I don't think
I listened too much rock and roll in my teens.
Speaking low.
Now, after you finish your job Saturday, come by the meal because it's our anniversary meal.
Oh, I'd love it.
You'll like it?
Yeah.
Now, do you still have the
and it's Italian.
High school plan?
And it's Italian. Well, oh, you don't want that because then I'll judge it, right?
And you still have the high school plan working?
Oh, yeah. Can I tell you guys about those boys? Oh, as my grandmother would say, Lordy Moses. These three young men, two of them in particular, show up out of nowhere. I mean, I didn't ask them. I didn't make an ask. I didn't beg, nothing. They just show up one day, and I'm liking them because I'm looking them over, right? I'm thinking good backs, strong arms, big necks. I'm loving them for my warehouse, right? These guys showed up all summer long. You know who I'm talking about. These three boys, and I think, Megan, you did a story on them, I think. I thought you did, but well, she will. These guys showed up, I mean, and they came Mondays, they came Wednesdays, they came Saturdays. They did whatever I wanted to do, them to do, and they came the whole summer long. And when school started, I thought, oh, I'm going to lose my guys, right? No, 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 Suzanne, we're going to keep coming. They're not there because the law said to come. They're just showing because I think they get the mission, right? So they're coming on Saturdays. So now I'm thinking, ha-ha, clay to mold, right? So I said, how are we going to spin this in a way for you to make some money for the food bank? And the one boy says, well, you know, I'm on the wrestling team. Why don't we have a wrestling meet, a pack the stands or pack the stadium or pack the, I forget what it's called. And he goes, and we'll dedicate it to the food bank. And then he talked to his coach, and then he talked to the athletic director at Ferndale High School, and now they might give us over all their concession proceeds. And this whole thing is morphed because these kids came and gave of themselves and got out of their headspace. All of you could do it. I'd welcome you. They're bringing their friends now. The one guy brought his brother, who's at UW. This girl that this one guy brought, this girl, you know, she has taken over our front desk area. She's so poised and on it, and it's just growing. And so we were really attracting good souls and good spirits. So, and I have to make another mention if I can do another shout-out. We have a board member, Jim LeMaster, who's the Ferndale Santa. Do you guys know Jim at all? You saw him in the parade. Well, Jim is a gentleman farmer, as we would call him, in the East Coast, retired, has a big piece of land on Paradise Road, and he grows food for the food bank. In the month of August, he gave 1,175 pounds of food to the food bank. That's a lot of food. I had to lift most of it. It was a lot of food, zucchinis, onions, garlics, I mean, just everything. Background, our backyard gardeners here in Ferndale in the month of August donated approximately 715 pounds of food to the food bank, backyard gardeners. So there's lots of good stuff going on. But when we hit the winter months, we don't get our lovely produce anymore. And I know that everybody probably read about our $25,000 grant from Walmart. That seems like an awful lot of money. But to feed the people that we have at the level that we're feeding them, which means our average family walks out with about 70 pounds of food. That's nothing. 70 pounds of food is maybe 3 bags of food. And if you have a family of 5, you get 2 cans of chicken noodle soup. That doesn't even feed everybody. So we're really hitting up that period where we get a lot of emphasis, but we got to somehow figure out how to keep it going. Because come January, February, March, it is a barren wasteland, and I will be begging something fierce. So what I'd like to do is get into place some times where we can, you know, start stocking up, building up, and getting it out to the folks who need it.
So, Councilor MB, if you get a chance, it's hard to really kind of relate to what they're doing unless you work there. And really, I mean, I know you're all busy and you all have things to do, but, boy, if you just take a Saturday and you get to work with some great kids, they still might make fun of you. But
yeah.
But, boy, give a Saturday, and they'll find something to do, and then you get kind of a true indication of really what's going on. Lloyd?
Mark, what was our contribution last year to the food bank financially, and what is it going to be this year?
Good questions, both good questions. I don't have the right report with me to answer that tonight. I can certainly get that to you tomorrow. Thank you.
Can I just make one comment, too, though? I think it's phenomenal, and I said this to the mayor when we met, of the support that we do get from you guys, and even in tough times, I am so grateful that we still made a line item on your budget. And I think it shows the quality of you all, too. It's easy to hack off programs that you think are going to get support somewhere else. And you guys are really fostering security in your own community, and that's really important.
If you have one, would you please leave me a card, maybe a card? But my question would be, you mentioned a very large number of clients. It was 100-something thousand that you mentioned earlier.
130,000 individuals
that's
in a year.
Right. Yeah, so if you could estimate the number of Ferndale families, like a family, distinct family units that are served
yeah.
a month. Say families come at least once a month for help.
Oh, yeah. We serve per month, well, let's see.
Well, distinct families. So
distinct. So non what do you call it? Non-duplicated is what we call it in the federal terms.
Okay.
So we probably serve approximately 300 families non-duplicated, 300 to 450.
That's a lot. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. And let me share something else, too. 8x11 sheet of paper. TFAP is one of our sources of food. It's the federal government. I don't know what the acronym stands for. I have no idea. But when I started in November, our TFAP list of food donations from the feds was maybe a page and maybe a page and a half. In the last 4 months, my pages have looked like this.
Shrunk.
I'm down to maybe a third of a page.
And that is
that's from the federal government.
Commodities that come to you in
yes.
form that you break it up?
Yes. Yes. Our support that we get from the state, thank goodness for this year, has stayed in place. And so our money that what we get from the state is called EFAP. Emergency Food Assistance Program. I do know what that one means. That, because it was smaller, I could remember that. That one is a monetary support, and our numbers stayed approximately the same. We maybe lost a couple of $100. I try to spend my money on staples, like frozen proteins, where families get more than one meal out of it, milk, eggs, cheese. But we're not getting the help that we were getting, and it's just shrinking. Frozen protein, I just got from Northwest Harvest, which is a food distributor. They're like a mammoth food bank that gets food and then trucks it out. I just got frozen protein from them, and I haven't had frozen protein for them in months. So the frozen protein that I've got, I've purchased. I had a meeting last Thursday with Steve. I don't know his last name. He's the butcher at Cost Cutter. He sought me out to say, well, you know, I have this whole butcher shop thing as a part-time job, too, out of my house. And if we can get a cow donated, I'll cut it up and package it for free. And I said, and that's what I said. And I was like, what does that mean, right, being the girl, right? What does that mean? He said, that means 600 pounds of meat. That will go a long way. But not so long, right? So We got 6,400 pounds of food from the postal drive. That only lasted us maybe less than 2 months.
Okay, so last Sunday in October, we got a focus. Okay, Council, we'll move forward.
Okay, thank you.
Round of applause for our food bank. Okay, we'll move to C2. And so, Councilperson Goodrich, you pulled it off. So, direction?
I just had a question. This probably goes to Yori. In the revisions that we're making here, why did the 1992 stuff remain in the ordinance, because it seems like that's been a while ago?
I don't have a good answer for you.
The city clerk actually wrote this. The 1992 stuff just simply remained from previous iterations of your code. It's always remained. I'm unsure why. Perhaps they felt that historically it provided perspective that we had 1 year where fire danger was high enough to actually limit it more. Because that's the reason why there was that limitation for 1 year, fire danger, in Western Washington. So it remained in, I believe it remains in the version that I had proposed originally because it was already there and I saw no reason to take it out. Someone prior to me might have found it have value. However, since then, you know, in talking about a new change, it makes sense to just completely scrap the entire section and simply make it concurrent with state law. So it would go away under what staff is now proposing.
Well, if it's based off of fire danger, it seems simpler just to put in a thing that these are the times and things unless they're,
county fire marshal.
County fire marshal or somebody declares, otherwise or something. But, I just thought we were striking out and making changes. I just didn't understand why that was, wasn't just striked out while we're making changes.
I didn't make the change because that was not the motion in front of me at committee. Basically, I only changed what the motion at committee was because I didn't want to go beyond the bounds of what my instructions were.
Yeah, speaking toward. Yeah, I don't recall us having really any discussion on the 1992 language at committee. Does anybody else on the committee remember? And I kind of find it odd as well. But
I don't believe it came up.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that since it's now on the regular agenda, you can't move to adopt this with that portion stricken.
You like that?
Yeah.
Best person, Lutzler?
Yeah, it's my understanding that there's interest in staff in simply adopting the RCW ordinance as our ordinance, and that we neglected to reference the New Year's Eve allowance by the state law of the New Year's Eve celebration. And I don't think we've included that. And so maybe Mr. Taylor, you could explain a little bit more why we should head that direction.
It was largely from during committee, what happened was we had a rather quick motion made about one specific thing. The goal, as I understood it from committee, and I believe the chief could speak to, was to become concurrent with state law and simply adopt what they had. So when I went to write the proposed ordinance based on the motion, I wrote only what happened at committee because I felt that was appropriate, and I sent it off to have it reviewed. And the chief did point out that, there are differences between even that motion and what state law says. And so we thought, why don't we simply make it as concurrent as possible? The easiest way to do that is to do what several other jurisdictions do and simply adopt by reference the state's chapter on fireworks regulations, which is 70.77.
And so the council knows this, but maybe the audience, we allowed an extra day that the state does not allow.
Correct.
First and foremost, we allow fireworks on the 6th of July. We can't do that.
Correct.
And so that's the main thing we were trying to change. But we just simply neglected dealing with the 31st. So it's just simpler. I think that was the intent of committee, was to be in alignment with the RCW.
I thought that, but that wasn't the motion, so that's not why I wrote it that way.
And maybe council thinks differently, but that's what I understand.
Yeah.
I'd like to make a motion to send this back to the committee to look at this to see if we just adopt the RCW and make reference to that versus doing something here tonight and then turning around and have to do it again. I mean, we have until December 31st, New Year's, if that's an issue. It doesn't seem like this is a pressing issue to have to be solved tonight. And if the direction is to go to the RCW, then why not just bring that forward?
That is a long motion.
No, I didn't mean that. The motion is to send it back to the committee to explore just adopting the RCW.
Second to that, to move that.
Also.
Yeah, I'll second that. Councilperson
Althezzi?
Well, I'll speak towards it. That's fine with me because we really didn't have any discussions. And it's my understanding that we're getting this one section in compliance with state ordinance. And there might be some other sections that, you know, we may not want to be exactly aligned with them. So that sounds prudent.
Okay, so on the motion to move it back to committee, discussion, Councilperson Mutchler.
Yeah, I, since the chief is here, it might be helpful if the full council before the committee could hear if there's a sense from the chief if he would is aware of any reason why we'd want to deviate from RCW. There might be, there might not be. But,
good evening, council. This confusion stems principally from an oversight by your chief of police. I thought I had provided the committee with an explanation of the differences between the RCW and our ordinance. In fact, I hadn't, and I looked for it in my notes and realized that I had not made that explanation earlier, and I was making assumptions at that last committee meeting that simply were false. I had not told you everything. The one principal aspect that was corrected by the committee regarding the RCW and our current ordinance is that part dealing with June 6th, as I recall.
July
6th, which is not permitted under the RCW, and we may not, by state law, amend that ordinance to enlarge it. We may, however, amend our ordinances to take away from the state statute. So we can be more restrictive, but we may not enlarge upon the dates that the state legislature has designated for the discharge of fireworks. So we took the and corrected that one deficiency. Councilmember Mutchler, as I recall, made that motion. We corrected that. At the same time, there is a December part that the RCW allows, December 31st, as well as the 1 hour at on the July 4th between 11 and midnight. The RCW says you can shoot fireworks up to midnight on July 4th. The ordinance, as I recall, says 11 o'clock. This is off the top of my head. So those are more restrictive, and you may, in fact, wish to consider those restrictions. The bottom line is this. That in almost all, in every jurisdiction I checked with that had modified, Everson being one in Bellingham, that had modified the RCW to make it more restrictive than what the RCW permitted, they were unable absolutely to enforce it. And for a number of reasons, and I think I set them forth in that email that I sent to all of you. So if I had to make a recommendation, it would be to bring our ordinance into complete compliance with the RCW, that part that rectifies the July 6th is mandatory. You have to do that. The rest of it is entirely discretionary, up to you.
Okay. Any questions, please, Chief? Councilperson Mutchler?
It's more to the council. So the council needs to consider, which I'll come back to you, of course, is whether you want to restrict December 31st, or do any other restrictions. And council may not know, but this came to our committee, Neighborhood Services Committee, because of a complaint about noise from a citizen who was advocating a much tighter window, which we can do, by the way. But after a testimony from the chief, we just felt like it was better just to go with what the RCW allowed and be consistent with that.
Okay, the motion before you is to put this subject back to committee. So all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion carries 7-0. Okay, next up is the public hearing on the campaign sign. I'll go to our planning director, Lori Burnett.
Good evening, Council. What I'm passing around right now is a kind of Cliff Notes version of what's in your packet. It incorporates some of the proposed changes that our city attorney identified, and I've numbered them so that we can refer to this version if we have any questions or comments. As the mayor said, tonight is a public hearing. The purpose of tonight's public hearing is to make permanent the temporary changes that council adopted in July for political and campaign signs. As you'll recall, back in July, we realized that an existing code provision that had actually been in place for several years required or placed a limitation on campaign signs in on private property that was less than what we had grown accustomed to. Specifically, it had a maximum size of 16 square feet for campaign signs in residential, in commercial zones, and 4 square feet in residential zones, whereas the city had become accustomed to up to 32 square feet in commercial zones, and several candidates had already purchased their signs. Council adopted an interim zoning control. You were able to do so without the benefit of a public hearing, provided that you did ultimately have a public hearing within, I believe it was 60 days. So you are doing that right now. The Planning Commission held a public hearing last Wednesday. Before that public hearing, we went through the sign ordinance, looking specifically at campaign and political signs. We also ran it by the city attorney to see whether there were any other areas of weakness in the sign provisions. And the city attorney did find that there were some areas of weakness that needed some clarification. There were also some opportunities, as we saw going through the primary season, where without necessarily changing the actual rules themselves, it was appropriate to clarify the policies in place so that there was no question as to who was responsible for campaign signs, what the process for removing campaign signs would be, the allowances in a public right-of-way versus private property, so on and so forth. So what that results in are proposed changes to the code that are expanded beyond what you voted for in July. They're changes that we feel are necessary and appropriate in order to convey the message of allowance for signs in the city, as well as being clear what the enforcement requirements are as well. So I'll go through the changes fairly briefly. One of the first changes, and again, I'm going to be referring to the handout that I just passed out because it doesn't include all of the other elements that we haven't changed.
Did you have one for everybody?
I have one for everybody on council.
I didn't pass them around.
Oh. Sorry.
I thought it was really thick.
No. That's why I sent it out, because it's not as thick as the other.
Okay, thank you.
The first issue has to do with the definition section, where right now we have one definition for campaign and political signs. Those are two very different types of signs, where a campaign sign is a sign that advertises a candidate or candidates for public elective office, a political party, or promotes a position on a ballot issue for a date-specific election. A political sign is – a campaign sign is temporary by nature. A political sign can be permanent. That would be where an individual on their private property wishes to show their support for a food bank, for instance, to show their support for the whales, so on and so forth like that. These can be permanent positions that are somewhat smaller signs but are, again, permanent. So we propose creating two different definitions, a political sign definition and a campaign sign. Political signs can be permanent signs on private property. Campaign signs are temporary signs either on private property or public property, and we'll get back to that discussion a little bit later. On pages 3, 4, 5, there are only minor numbering changes. There is no change to the policies in place. Just as part of the proposed renumbering of certain sections, we needed to make appropriate reference to those sections. On page 6, we include a statement, signs on public property, prohibiting signs on public property, with the exception of temporary notices of pets, and I do want to wish to add the word temporary notices of pets or property lost in the immediate vicinity. The concept here is that in parks or other public property, you cannot advertise your business. You cannot advertise your home for sale or a garage sale. But if you happen to lose your wallet or your pet, that is a realistic, normal form of public discourse that could be permitted. Moving on, we established one section for campaign signs, whereas it used to read political and campaign signs. We state that the campaign signs on private property shall be limited to the size restrictions that we formally adopted in July. That was 4 square feet on private property in residential zones and 32 square feet on private property in commercial zones. We also state that whereas we've identified the size allowed on private property, there are limitations on campaign signage in the right-of-way, and we go through that. We make it clear that it's the ultimate responsibility of the candidate to maintain their signs, even if it is not the candidate that has actually installed them on the public right-of-way. The reason for this is if there's a need to move the sign, the city needs to know that we can go to one individual to contact them to see that it's done, rather than go to a candidate and suggest that they move their sign for the purpose of obstructing traffic or so on and so forth, only to be told, well, I didn't put it up, I don't have any idea. It's the ultimate responsibility of the candidate, and that is something that legal decisions have shown very clear. We move on from there. Minor changes that do not alter what our existing code actually says until we get to page 7, where that's where we have our private property campaign signs not exceeding 4 square feet / 32 square feet. We maintain that through removal of signs. The removal of signs section is a relatively new section, and this is one that we borrowed from another jurisdiction. And it was one of the main points of concern from the Planning Commission the other night. For nearly 10 years, the city has had a requirement that signs in the public right-of-way and on private property be removed within 7 days. It's really just a line item there. It's just one line that says that and has said that. The Planning Commission was concerned that the city, by basically adopting these paragraphs which lay out the process for removing signs or where the city would notify the persons or individuals responsible for the signs, that the city was encroaching onto new territory by possibly enforcing or requiring the removal of campaign signs on private property. They were not concerned about removal on public property, but were concerned that the city was breaking new ground, so to speak, on this issue.
And Yuri, can I just ask you?
Yes, sir.
This is going to be an important point with me, and you're touching on it now. Do you think the Planning Commission, because I thought about this having attended, was under the impression that that we really weren't breaking new ground? It's still the same ordinance. We've always required signs to come down after 7 days. I think they were under the impression that we were starting something new and adopting something new. And that puzzled me in the evening. And as I went home, I thought, I think they thought this is a brand new thing. We've always done this.
I think so, too. I think that that's absolutely correct. And following the chief's lead, full disclosure, I didn't expect the Planning Commission to have those questions about that component of the ordinance because it was not new. And I think that I failed to respond to them by reminding them that this has been on the books, but we were expanding it to provide some clarification of what it means that signs need to be removed within 7 days, that on public property, the public right-of-way, if they're not removed within after the seventh day, it's the city that's going to remove them. We would remind the candidates at right after the election, basically, that the city will go out, but then the city would remove them. We would also clarify the difference between a primary election where signs can come up, remain up until the election is certified, and a general election where they have to be down 7 days afterwards. We also make statements in there that on private property, rather than tell a private property owner that they are guilty of a criminal violation for keeping a sign up beyond 7 days, it would actually go through the nuisance process, which is much more informal, notifying them that there are those requirements, giving them 10 days to work it out and to figure it out, and to allow that negotiation before there was any sort of fine or penalty of that nature. Most times people don't realize that there is a regulation, as the Planning Commission didn't either. That's the substance of the removal of signs, and I believe, and I don't know if you'll agree, Councilmember Mutchler, that was really where the Planning Commission had some concerns. And I know that Councilmember Goodrich had a question. I would say that the Planning Commission voted to recommend approval of only the changes that were made in July. They wanted to reject the other changes that were proposed. And again, in all honesty, I don't think that they were completely aware of the fact that these changes, in my opinion, do not change policies so much as clarify existing policies.
Could I just follow up, if Councilmember Brent would mind if I do that? I think they didn't appreciate a distinction that you're bringing here tonight of political versus campaign. The vote November 8th for so-and-so versus I'm a Tea Party person or something like that. I don't think they even discussed that, which was significant, to let council know the tenor of the evening, which was very interesting. I was surprised by it. I was barely there, and that started to heat up a bit. It was a citizen and a commission member that I think they would say they would have the right, First Amendment right, to put a campaign sign, vote for so-and-so, and they have the right to leave that up 365. I believe that would be a summary of what they would feel. And I think the Planning Commission, at the end of the evening, would have probably – they didn't state this, but I think the consensus was that that's what they were saying. And they don't want to change that, although they were of the realization that that's already – the restriction is you have to pull those things down on public – excuse me, on right-of-way and private property. So I've been thinking about this all day, Yuri, about wondering if – the Planning Commission is another whack at this, because there's a number of issues I don't think they really wrestled with.
Well, and that would certainly be...
I'm not so sure I completely agree. I guess let's go back with the exact wording of the person that started the discussion, that the city will not and will never have the right to come on my property and tell me what to do with the sign because it's my property. And so that premise, I mean, I'm kind of disagreeing a little bit with you. I haven't sat down.
I'm not disagreeing with the values of the laws. I'm just saying what a sense of the commission was an agreement to that, and they don't think they really dealt with it in terms of what the RCU, what the state allows and can restrict.
No, you're correct. I think that was a stance that the whole commission caught that wave of. It's my property.
Right. Exactly.
Put whatever sign, and the city's authority doesn't go forward to that.
And by the way, I agree with the changes as I understand them. I'm suggesting if we go ahead, we're going to have a public hearing in a moment here, and if we adopt this. I suspect that the commission members and the community members are going to read the minutes and go, what the heck did they do? Because I think there's a process. I think this is one way you have a liaison on it, is to kind of bring people along. And I think they can be brought along, but I think that somehow that – you were there. I remember that. That was a very interesting discussion.
Yeah, the way it changed rapidly.
And I don't know if there's a timeliness issue here. Why we have to do this, we could do it. I think there may be consensus here, but I think the Planning Commission is going to be felt like they haven't really dealt with this.
The city clerk just made an excellent point. If we do not adopt anything, the previous regulation will go away. So, in effect, for the November election, all of the larger signs will have to be removed. So There is some timeliness issue.
Okay, so I have Councilperson Goodrich and then Malpezzi.
Well, under the section of removing the signs, when I read this, I was confused because it talks about you got to remove your sign within 7 days, otherwise the city's going to come and take them away and charge you $25. But yet it says it's under the discretion of the Director of Public Works and Utilities. So, and I thought when in committee we talked about the fact that before the signs get taken out and a $25 fee charge, that the candidate would be notified that, hey, there's one of your signs. Because as candidates, you don't know where all your signs are going to end up. And like I said, I went out and collected all my signs, and I found out through a conversation with somebody that one of my signs was that I thought was taken was actually moved 2 blocks. By somebody trying to be funny. And so I didn't know my sign was there. And so I thought we were talking about a little clause that the candidate would be notified, hey, you have a sign up on Vista, you know, go get it. And then if they don't go get it, then they'd be charged that. But
and we did add in, first of all, it's under the direction of the Public Works Director. So they would be removed. It wouldn't be, I happen to like this candidate, so I'm not. It would be the direction of them, not discretion. And then we did add on Section 5 of that subsection, city staff will inform all candidates in writing of their responsibility.
Well, I read that, I'm confused. You know, if after 7 days is the truck's going to go around the city and start yanking signs, and then I get a bill for, hey, we pulled 10 of your signs at $25 a piece, or are we going to be notified that, hey, one of your signs is over here, you need to get it out. It seems confusing on that. And maybe there needs to be some more clarity on how that's going to work.
And the council could provide some direction on that. It seems that what you're asking may be different from how I understood it, where I understood it that staff would inform candidates immediately after an election, start removing your signs because we will be removing them if you don't. It sounds like what you're suggesting is that when staff observes a specific sign in a location, that we would then inform the candidate before we remove it.
My feeling is I think the candidate should have the option to be able to go out there and remove his sign before he gets dinged $25 or whatever for a sign that he didn't know was even there to get. I don't know if that's logistically able to do or not, but on a big election, or whatever, there could be a lot of signs out there that you just don't know. Yeah.
Well, and this puts the onus on the crew, and I don't want to speak for the crew as far as what they can or can't do.
We have more pressing issues
exactly.
Public Works than picking up political or campaign signs.
Yeah.
I guess I hear just from experience in other cities, it's possible if there's no penalty that a less than successful candidate will say, let the city pick up my signs, I don't care.
Well, I'm not disagreeing with the penalty.
Right.
I'm just saying that as a candidate, I would like to know that there's a sign out there that needs to be removed that I didn't know about before I get a bill from the city for $25 for a sign.
As long as, and I think maybe we can tighten it up, because in this day and age, probably every candidate has pretty accessible contact information from email to cell phone to everything. So it really shouldn't be that big of a deal.
It's not.
I know on the one, we tried to contact the candidate and said, your sign's up. The person wants it gone on the property, and we didn't get any response back, so there was probably appropriate. Councilperson Malpezzi, then Hanson.
I agree with that comment, and I don't. I was the one that brought that up in the committee level, and I don't think that quite addresses where I was going at. Although I don't have any immediate verbiage to offer up right now. I had a similar but different concern with the process. There's two questions. One, did the Planning Commission make a recommendation? I mean, normally things, when they go through the Planning Commission process, we get a
you know, up or down vote on, you know, if this, you know, passed, if they recommend it. And I don't.
Yeah, your statement was they wanted to do, they were happy with adding 4x8s and then the size, and then they wanted to wipe out everything else.
Everything after your, they liked what you did in July, and they didn't want anything else.
I heard that was the general consensus, but I didn't hear if there was a vote, and usually that, you know, ends up in the staff report. And the other process question, it seems a little odd that the timing, this went through committee Wednesday day and then through the planning commission Wednesday night, potentially sending it off in a totally different direction, and it just seems like the timing of this whole thing is off a little bit. I agree with Councilman Munchlin on that.
Councilperson Hansen?
A couple of things. The onus to take down a sign that's on private property will be on the private property owner. What happens where the line is fuzzy between what's right-of-way and what's private property? And in some instances, people have put up signs, even now, today, that they think are on right-of-way when, in fact, they're on private property, and the private property owner has chosen not to make an issue of it. Are we going to ding the private property owner at that point as a nuisance because he doesn't take down a sign that the candidate actually thought was on the right-of-way? I'm just throwing that out as a, it's going to come up somewhere along the line. I'm wondering if we can solve this for tonight by reestablishing the temporary regulations that we put together for 45 additional days from today. That will get us through. If at that point it's not resolved, it doesn't make any difference anyway. And send the rest of it, because what seems to be in contention is the removal of signs.
I think
that's the fee for removal of signs and the difference between campaign signs that have to be removed and political signs that can go on forever. And get that clarified by the Planning Commission, and I will so move that. That's to reestablish the temporary regulations for 45 additional days, and send the whole package back to the Planning Commission.
Second.
Okay, we have Councilperson Mutchler and then Councilperson Goodrich.
I have two lines of attack here. I think we can pass exactly what the Planning Commission passed, even though I'm confident they didn't quite fully grasp what they were doing. I don't mean that with any disrespect at all. And then in a way to say we can send all that back to them. Other stuff about, because there is a the sense that 7 days they need to come down. That's already, we're not adding that. That's just existing. If the Planning Commission thinks that's a bad idea, and maybe it is a bad idea, they can work on that and send that back to us. I also want to bring into the record, I do want this into the record, I don't know if it's Yuri or Sam found this, the Washington Supreme Court has addressed the issue of whether or not we can have people remove signs, political signs, dated election political signs, post-election, and we can do that.
Campaign signs.
Campaign signs that are dealing with election, and that's the Collier versus Tacoma, there may be a citizen or two might want to look that up. So it is something we can do. The Planning Commission, or whoever, the council may not want to do that. We don't care if a person has a Bush 2004 sign in their driveway and spend there forever. I mean,
Dukakis.
We may not care about the caucus. There you go. But if we do care about it, I think it's the onus is now on the Planning Commission to come back and deal with that. I think we can pass what you're bringing to us today because it doesn't change anything except do what Mel's suggesting here. And then explain to the Planning Commission that they may have misunderstood it a little bit and then have them take it on at another time.
I would think that would be correct. You could make those changes permanent,
mm-hmm.
And then direct staff and the Planning Commission to resolve the other.
It's the same intention. I think we cut out. So I would vote against Mel's motion.
The only problem you have is, I mean, you made a motion. This is a public hearing, so we haven't gone to the public hearing part. So your motion is kind of out of order.
Actually, I need to withdraw the motion because without the public hearing, we can't. Well, I will withdraw the motion.
Okay. And Councilor
Goodrich, then Zimmerman.
While we're asking questions, skip back on the page 7 on the size of signs. One thing that caught my eye was under D1D, not to exceed 5 feet in height or 10 feet in width. Does that mean I can't take a 4x8 sign, which we said we can do, and rotate it?
Correct.
Vertically. I'm still the 32 square feet. I'm a 4x8 sign, but now I'm 8 feet tall.
Correct.
So, therefore, I can't do that.
Correct.
That brings my question of why not?
Because I have a 32-square-foot sign. As it turned out, we like
4x8. Yeah. In case somebody got creative in their signs, decided to do a vertical one instead of a horizontal one.
More potential for food water.
I understand that aspect of it, yeah, but yet there's nothing in here that says I can't take my 4x8 sign that's horizontal and put it 10 feet up in the air, either, on posts, or have a structure in the front of my house and then put my sign on top of that structure, to where now it's, higher than the 4 feet. So I was kind of curious about that height thing. I know it wasn't addressed in the changes, but it just jumped out at me, and I thought, well, 10 feet long, but then I guess that was for banners or something that they were looking at. But how to get, I was thinking 32 square feet maximum, and how can I do that with a 5 foot tall thing or a 10 foot tall thing, or and stuff. And it kind of, my mind couldn't grasp that, the whys and why nots. And so I don't know if that's something that we need to look at. Or, like I said, are we going to allow them, if you can only go 5 feet high, then can you put it on top of something that's already 8 feet or 10 feet in the air?
Well, and one of the things, it's a really good point. In trying to regulate political and campaign signs, we talked about it. The main goal of political and campaign signs is to be visible and to be creative and to, that's different. And so it would take a book that thick to try to anticipate absolutely everything. So there are some things where, to your point, the 5 feet versus 10 feet, that can be looked at, where maybe there are some things that doesn't make as much rational sense because, what if you just twist it over? But then what if you put something on a tree, or what if you put it on a, this type of structure or boat, or, is that a vehicle? We're not going to be able to regulate and close all the loopholes, because that's part of the fun of the game.
So my point is, why not just leave it at 32 square feet and not have the 5 foot and 10 foot things in there at all? And as long as you're within your 32 square feet and you're not blocking visibility by putting your sign vertical, then give it that option.
I have one of those.
Okay, back in order, we'll go Councilor Zimmerman and then Metzler.
I'm just amazed that we're spent this much time. I've been watching this for 20 years, and like you said, every time you think you got it nailed down, someone like our good buddy up the street will try some way around it. And it's to me, it's a First Amendment issue. You've got our city administrator quoting the Supreme Court saying why we can't take the yellow kiosk paper stands off the street because it's First Amendment rights. But yet someone local that we got some power over, that's not a company or corporation, that all of a sudden, now we're going to put the clamps on them, and we're going to have our city people picking them up, and we're going to have you fines. That's just a little bit too far beyond. I almost like Mel's thing of run it out for 45 days and then worried about it later. And most of the times, after someone has lost, even their opponents will pick up their sign and go, and remove them for you.
That's actually
thank you. First of all, nobody up here is interested in violating First Amendment rights. I make my living with the First Amendment, and a lot of us do, frankly. And I think the purpose is not to restrict the speech or the campaign or the political speech or whatever it is, but that you're trying to have a reasonable amount of aesthetic consideration for neighbors. And I in a discussion with Yuri about this, I brought up the 1 foot by 32 foot banner.
when I first read this thing a month and a half ago when we passed the original temporary deal, was that you could conceivably have a 1 foot by 32 foot banner. Now, that may be fine with council. I personally like the idea that things are a little more uniform, a little more kind of normal. But if council wants something like that, you could certainly remove that. I think Yuri is trying to find a way to address that. And I just don't see it as a restriction on freedom of speech to say, you know, we want you to campaign, get those signs out there, but, you know, let's have some reasonable sense of consideration of the aesthetics of the community.
Well, and one of the things that Sam might be able to speak a little bit more about it is it's interesting where the courts have found or have not found, where they have said cities that have restricted the size so much, where, for instance, they might say you can have a 1 foot by 6-inch sign. That's too small. But at a certain point in freedom of speech, if you can convey your message by talking on a smaller sign versus yelling on a bigger sign doesn't convey the message better than a smaller sign if you can still read it, basically. And I think that that's something that the courts have said is you can't regulate too small a sign, but once you expand it out, people can still read your sign if they're 32 by 1 or if they're, you know, 4 by 8.
And I think of it in terms of balancing two things. One of our free speech rights, but also I'm a neighbor. And what if we've all got, I'm sure we've all got great neighbors. I've got terrific neighbors. What if you have a neighbor that just wants to push that? I don't know, a neighbor with a whole bunch of, well, that would be residential. What's the tallest, what's the size of a residential site? 16 feet for the residential, 4 feet. Okay, that's not very big. 1 by 4, a bunch of those. Maybe that's okay. But you've got to decide what you want.
Okay, anything more before we open up the public hearing?
Nope.
Okay, so open up the public hearing portion of it. Public hearing is a formal opportunity to give testimony to the council for consideration of their decision-making process. If you intend to speak, it's necessary that you sign the sheet that is located up front, or we'll just, after that, we'll just do a show of hands. Written comments may also be submitted to the city clerk prior to the beginning of the hearing. When the mayor calls your name, proceed as follows. Proceed to the speaker's rostrum, the microphone. Clearly state your name and address. If you're speaking as a representative for another person or organization, so state. State whether you're a proponent, opponent, or neither. Limit your comments to 3 minutes. After all comments are heard, if you have something to add that has not already been stated, at the discretion of the mayor, you may be given an additional 2 minutes. There will be no demonstration or conclusion of anyone's presentation. During the public testimony period of the public hearing, the council staff and the audience will remain silent. After your presentation, council members may wish to ask you questions. After the last person has spoken, the hearing will be closed and the council will enter a regular session. The subject of the hearing will usually appear as an agenda item for council discussion, decision, or referral. The audience may not comment during the council's deliberations unless questioned by the council for clarification. These rules are intended to promote an orderly system of holding a public hearing to give every person an opportunity to be heard, and ensure that no individuals are embarrassed by exercising the right to free speech. Hopefully everybody listened to that, because I won't repeat that for the next public hearing right after that. So anyone wishes to come forward and speak on the campaign sign issue? One, no, didn't see a sign? I saw a twitch there. I'll make one public comment. It doesn't have anything to do with here, but I'd love the media to pick up on this. And hopefully the high school students can go back and tell some of their fellow students. Ferndale is now famous throughout the county as the home of sign theft. More signs are removed and stolen. It takes a lot of time to put up signs, and it's really, I'd love the media to get the information out. It's a felony. It's a felony. So if you're caught stealing a campaign sign, that's not an easy, you know, if you're a high school student thinking it's a fun thing for a football practice, and if you're caught doing that, it's a felony. It's not a misdemeanor. It's not a little slap on the hands. It's a felony, so it's a serious crime. So be aware of that, and I hope that message is shared. Okay, so I'll now close the public hearing portion. Council, further discussion. Now, the direction, let's go back to the direction is we do need some sort of action tonight in order to, I mean, we could do what Councilperson Hansen had suggested earlier, is that we could extend the temporary.
I have not spoken to our attorneys about that. I believe that the temporary ordinance expires after a, gosh, I want to say it's 90 days, but that there has to be a hearing within 60 days of it. I don't know that there are provisions to then extend it again. There may well be, but I'm not – do you believe?
You can.
You can? Okay.
So there's an action in terms of what the Planning Commission was thinking. Councilperson Mutchler has hand up first.
So I'm interested in making that motion. Just a quick question of clarifying. So if we adopt the staff recommendation for basically codifying the new sizes for the commercial areas, the residential area sizes are the same. We're not changing the takedown period, but we're shifting to a nuisance category of enforcement as opposed to a criminal category of enforcement. Is that close to what we're doing here?
Yes, and you're clarifying some of the process steps, but that really hits.
It's a really hits it. Yeah. So, and so, by passing this, a political sign can stay up all year round, mm-hmm. still limited by size, mm-hmm. but a campaign sign has to come down in 7 days.
And political signs are only on private property.
Only on private and right away.
No.
Campaigns. Yeah, gotcha. I'm with you.
Got it. Okay.
I got it. I'd like to make that motion then for the adoption of the staff recommendation on the campaign sign so you can decipher all that. I think it's just as you presented it.
As I presented it and shown here, this would not be what the Planning Commission recommended, correct? Is that
correct.
Your intent?
Yeah. Correct.
All second.
Okay, then move to second. Further discussion? Did you put your hand up?
For discussion. Okay. And since I made the motion, I think I can make the first.
Yeah.
I do want to let the Planning Commission know from this body that we're sympathetic to some of their concerns. It just seemed we were pressed by the clock to make some of these decisions tonight. And it's not our perception. Actually, my perception is that we're actually loosening things a little bit because we've moved it to a nuisance enforcement as opposed to the other. So if they want to do more to it, they certainly can consider that.
Councilperson Malpezzi?
Just do with the size and the zoning. How about the in-between zones between commercial and residential, so it's the multifamily, specifically the zone right around the roundabout near the high school? Cause
Residential.
Exactly.
It's the residential office zone.
There's a sign up there, and I don't have a problem with that size sign because it fits in with that particular house and everything.
Yeah, we did have an earlier one where we kind of did a ruling, no signs in roundabouts.
Yeah, this is the house just outside the roundabout, and there's a bigger than a four-foot sign. And
okay.
I don't have a problem with that sign, so I don't know.
What a painted rock.
It's not my sign.
Councilperson Messler?
Yeah, so the zonings that would be considered as allowing only the smaller campaign signs, that would include the urban residential, would it include RM 1.5, the RO,
no.
And the city center? Okay.
Residential office, city center.
Because in my mind, it would be nice if any place that had significant body of residents perhaps preferred the smaller signs as to having a big thing.
Now you're opening up.
So clarify which ones are included. Obviously all residential.
Reading it, it does provide more direction than you and I discussed earlier.
What page
are you on? On page 7, midway, D, number 1. Signs not exceeding 4 square feet for all parcels zoned for RS, single-family residential, or RM, multifamily residential, and 32 square feet in all other zoning districts.
So RO is not included?
RO is all other zoning districts. So
okay. If we're fine with that, I'm fine with that. But a lot of people do live in those areas. Consider it, well, this neighborhood, what do we call it, Sterling, Hamlin?
City center, yeah. That would be 32 square feet.
Something to consider.
Backwards.
But that's RO.
Yeah, backward.
Yeah, that's true. Very good point. Because the spirit is certainly zoning that's very neighborhood-ish,
residential-ish is what's being intended by that. I'm just asking the question whether we've included enough zoning in there to reflect that intent.
You got to grow the line somewhere.
He's commercial.
I realize that, yeah.
You also have RO zones that aren't primarily residential.
Yeah.
Office. So.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Further discussion by council or?
Can we have a second?
Okay. So all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Aye. Mayor breaks the tie, goes with staff recommendation.
No, ordinance.
Ooh.
Yeah, secret questions.
It's in the money, non-monetary.
Non-monetary. Unless you get fined.
This is money. Actually,
it is an ordinance.
Had to be majority.
I think it's all ordinances.
I think it's all ordinances.
So now we have no.
You can make another motion.
Yeah, because what is the date for it would become illegal then? Even though we've ignored it for 2 years, the date would be.
Gosh, 90 days, 3 months. It's in October.
Yes, it would be in October. So, okay.
Could I ask the negative vote? What the biggest concerns were?
You can. They have no obligation.
They don't have to
respond.
Sure.
I'll go with Councilperson Malpezzi first.
Combination of things. The apparent confusion, even from the liaison, about what the Planning Commission's true intentions were. That was definitely part of it. I feel there's some sections that could get cleaned up. I have a personal objection to, the one sign that is erected near the roundabout. I have no issues with it. I don't think anybody's ever complained about it. I think it's appropriate in that area. So that's a minor concern because it's only one sign. Those are some things that went through my head.
Okay, so council before you, because I mean to explain it kind of clearly, is there's some action that needs to be taken because we have allowed 4x8s in the past, but they've actually been illegal. We were trying to justify what really happened out there. So Councilperson Goodrich had his hand up first, then I saw Hanson, then Zimmerman.
Based off of the discussion that we had earlier, I'd like to make a motion that we extend the current interim sign sizes and ask the Planning Commission to review this one more time with the concerns that were brought up tonight.
Second?
I'll second.
Okay, second it. Further discussion. Councilperson Hanson, Zimmerman, then Mutchler.
I was going to make that motion.
Okay, so Councilperson Zimmerman.
Well, has anyone brought up the point that four of the people here, plus the mayor who's breaking the tie, all have a conflict of interest because we're currently running for political office? So for us to run, say, we're for it or against it, as we sit here and potentially vote in our own best interest, I think it's kind of crazy. Think about it.
I'd like to clarify that.
Okay, Councilperson Hanson.
When a majority of the council is in conflict of interest, it's considered not in conflict of interest. There's case law.
Say that again now.
When there's a majority that's in a conflict of interest, that has an apparent conflict of interest, you cannot defeat progress because you find everybody in a conflict of interest, which is what that would do, because you would disqualify the majority of the council, therefore they can't make any progress. The point is that the case law says, therefore, they're not in the conflict of interest. They may make a decision as long as it's reviewed.
Quote yourself,
our administrator.
Yeah, it has to do with the appearance of fairness. And as long as the council members acknowledge that the situation exists, but they also acknowledge that they believe they can act in an unbiased manner, then it's okay.
That's person Michael.
So there's two scenarios here. If this motion fails, there's a bunch of signs that need to come down, is my impression.
I'm not taking
fine. If this motion passes, we're really pretty much where we were. All of the nuisance ordinances are still excuse me, it's not a nuisance order. It's criminal. So it is still the 7-day. And so really the planning commission is probably going to want to take another whack at this because the status quo is the status quo, but it's probably not what the planning commission had intended. So in light of that, I'm going to vote in favor of the motion.
Okay, further discussion of the motion from council? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries 7-0. Okay, moving on.
Six.
Okay.
I was looking to restate the motion because I wasn't quite clear exactly what the lady
5-0-1 abstention.
I didn't vote. He did not vote. 6-0.
Were you,
more?
That's a no vote. Well, were you a vote or you a vote no?
Yes.
I didn't vote at all, but I was asking to. I was wanting to clearly state the motion as it was last.
Okay, so confusion of the motions. Can we do that to them?
It don't matter. It won't go
anywhere. Tell him he should have raised his hand earlier.
Yeah.
That's fine.
All right, next up, public hearing, removal of zoning floor area ratio.
All right. So we have, as the mayor said, another public hearing for you. The Planning Commission also had a hearing on this last week, and I believe it was quite a bit more straightforward as far as their recommendations. The Planning Commission had two votes, one of them for the city center zone and one of them for the urban residential zone. The city center zone was recommended approval 6-1. The urban residential zone was recommended approval 7-0. The two ordinances are very similar. What they would do is remove mention of a floor area ratio. The floor area ratio requires that new buildings in the downtown core be built to a certain bulk and size and massing. We have heard from various individuals that is overly restrictive and may have actually harmed the potential for new development in the interim. We also recognize that a lot has changed in the last 5 years since 2006. The economic bubble has burst, the growth bubble has burst, and we're in somewhat of a new culture now. So the proposed changes would clarify the purpose of the city center and urban residential zones. They would add some definition sections which were missing. It would alter some of the alleyway issues where there are alleys with vehicular access, increasing the setbacks in those areas or at least requiring a clear vision triangle, whereas the existing ordinance would allow someone to build a building right up next to that alleyway. There have been some, while there hasn't been new development, we've been able to picture in our heads how that could be a negative impact. And then finally, two more things. What it would do also is require that buildings be oriented on lots greater than 10,000 square feet in such a way as it would be over to one side or another instead of smack dab in the middle of a property, thereby making it unusable for all intents and purposes. We also clarified that single-family residences in the downtown core, which were not mentioned at all in the existing zones, are considered non-conforming uses. That's the way that we've treated them, but there was no mention, and so there was some ambiguity as far as people who wanted to improve their houses. The last thing that I would mention, the Planning Commission's direction, they recommended that we also emphasize that off-street parking is desirable above and beyond on-street parking. They were very concerned, and we show it in the proposed timeline a little bit, that current allowances that allow a new development to utilize on-street parking as partial credit for their parking spaces ends up being sort of a tragedy of the commons, where if everybody is being given credits for the same parking space, not all businesses can use that same parking space at one time, and that as we go through the next 2 years of reconceptualizing how to treat downtown, we need to recognize that even though there might not be a parking issue per se right now, if development occurs, they can't just depend on the existing on-street parking. And we have to look from the Planning Commission's perspective at either public parking off-street or new developments create their own off-street parking. So I'm happy to answer any questions you
question
may have.
For staff, before we open up the public hearing portion? Seeing none. Okay, open up the public hearing portion. Anyone from the public would like to come forward and speak? I see one.
Bobby.
Welcome, sir.
Thank you.
You may come forward.
My name is Bob Bell, 2085 Main Street. I represent the Ferndale Downtown Association, and, of course, I'm a business owner and a property owner in downtown, so I also have interest in what's going on here. I think this is very important, that the removal of the floor area ratio. I think there's been a lot of testimony to that fact and so on and so forth, and I just want to kind of reiterate that I think that by removing that, that I think there's a very good opportunity to bring development into downtown in the very near future, and there is interest, and I've certainly had conversation with people and businesses who are interested in coming downtown, and this certainly is the major obstacle in that happening. And I think it would also create that kind of the village aspect of downtown, so that example would be a restaurant or a bank or a medical office wants to come downtown, and they require off-street parking, and they require they would like to have drive-up, so on and so forth. So anything, I think it's really important for a lot of different reasons, and so I think it's important that this is the floor area ratio be removed. I also, in some of the discussions I picked up, and I don't know if it's a part of the recommendation tonight, but there was discussion about sunsetting that removal in 2 years. And I think it's important. I think a review would be more appropriate than actually sunsetting, for the simple reason that if a developer were to start tomorrow with interest in a piece downtown and 2 years they're out the door, I would say that that could discourage development, where if you review it in 2 years, you as a council will have an opportunity to look at it, or staff will have an opportunity to look at it and say, hey, it's working, or no, it's not working, and so on and so forth. But by having a sunset, I think it would really create hesitation in some of the developers that we want to have come down and spend the money. There were some other things that kind of came up in testimony and listening to it and so on and so forth. One of them is the alley closing. And I know that the alleys on Main Street where they come out and there's no visibility, I think that's really a problem. However, I think there's businesses that are interested in downtown that would like to have a drive-up window. So I think as you move down into 2nd or into Alder and down into those areas, there are alleyways there, of course, and these businesses would certainly like the opportunity to use these alleys for a drive-up facility, whether it be a coffee shop or a bank or even a restaurant. So I think that in discussing the alley closings, I think we need to be aware that they could be utilized for these businesses and still be have plenty of visibility as far as, you know, the building's not going right up to the corner so you can't see around, and that would create a problem. I think also there's been discussion about impact fees and hookup fees, and I think that because of the rental rates, and I think this is really important that you understand that the rental rates in Ferndale are so low, and they will get better as development happens. But it's really hard for a project to pencil with the impact fees the way they are and the hookup fees. So I think that should be addressed, whether it's addressed in this particular thing. Obviously, the FAR regulations are far more important at this point, but I think a discussion needs to be had in the near future on those two items as well. Because I think, as the mayor has said many times, zero is zero, and we've had no development downtown, so therefore we have all these properties that could be generating revenue for the city that aren't because of regulation and at this time I think we need a shot in the arm, and the city needs revenue. And I believe, and just from experience and conversations with developers, things, there are people out there, believe it or not, they're interested in doing projects. They want to do safe projects, and projects that they can get financing on have to be safe. And certainly I think there's an opportunity downtown because there is a void there, and I think it's an obvious void. And if we can make it affordable, I think it can happen. So. Anyway, thank you.
Okay, Councilor Zimmerman first, then Goodrich.
Bob, when you said safe, that means like politically stable safe or financially return safe? Or
right, I think all of the above. I mean, I think that it's important it's financially safe because they're not going to go anywhere unless there's the opportunity to make the project pencil. Yeah. And I think one of the things that Mike Cole pointed out several times, and sometimes it was hard to follow where he was going with that or even the comments he was making, but Bottom line, what he was coming up with is that if you were to build a normal 3,000-square-foot building on a 10,000-square-foot lot and the parking and everything else, by the time you get in hookup fees and impact fees, the project is upside down. And so that's what I'm talking about. And of course, bankers right now are very reluctant to bring in a project. They're very reluctant to loan any money, that alone, so that they want a safe project. And so a lot of times that means it has to have a tenant before you build, or it means that it's got to have some buffer there, if you will, for the return on investment. But if there's no return, not only will the developer not be interested, but, of course, the banks won't be interested. So.
And I support your concept of a review versus a sunset clause that it goes away, because, that gives that instability to the bank.
Well, absolutely. Plus, it gives the stability to the developer, knowing that it's not going to be pulled out from under him. And hey, it might not be 6 months, 8 months, a year down the road before a developer actually feels that everybody recognizes there's been a change and let's go. And if you have it too short, then of course, it dies before it gets started. So I think the review, and it would give the council the same opportunity to look at it and say, hey, this should die.
So clarification on that: it is not a sunset.
Oh, it is. Okay. Yeah. Oh, good. Okay. Yeah.
We listen.
Yeah.
Councilperson Goodrich?
Question for you. I know the removing the floor area ratio is the first step, but can this be done without the parking part being addressed? I remember that being an issue, or is it because we're changing the floor area ratio, the parking's not an issue now? Because I remember in the previous discussions, it seemed like they were together. And I'm just wondering, are we really accomplishing anything by removing the floor area ratio if the parking's still going to be a problem?
Well, I think in part you are, because now it'd be easier to have off-street parking because of the fact that you don't have the building there. So you could do for example, off-street parking without doing a two-story building. In other words, without doing a basement-type parking and so on and so forth. So I think from that standpoint it helps. I haven't looked at the whole parking regulation and so on and so forth, but I think that, it should be looked at, of course. I think that would only be appropriate because you are changing the floor area ratio there. You're removing that. That might have an impact on parking. It should be looked at. But I don't know. I'm specifically not aware of a problem at this point in time with it.
Is this where our city administrator wants to give his theory on parking regulations?
Yeah, I believe that we should have no parking regulations. I think it should be a business decision. Call me crazy.
No. In fact, you got my support.
Well, it's an interesting the concept is, I'm gonna take your quote that you go farther is,
sure.
Mr. Bell is an intelligent business person, and he knows what he needs to be successful. And I think that's part of the premise that we're going in this direction, is that Mr. Bell has his property, he's a business person, and he's going to build what is successful.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going to build what he needs to be successful.
Mm-hmm.
And if he doesn't have enough parking, then that's his fault for not being successful.
Right.
So
no.
Any more questions for Mr. Bell?
Thanks for being here. Mr. Bell, we're not dealing with impact fees tonight. However, I want to encourage you to keep coming at us on that issue.
Yeah.
We need to hear both sides of that. I also wanted to say, people like you who have spent money, who have purchased land, property, I think council and cities in general need to be so careful when we tell landowners what they can't do. We need to have a compelling reason to say don't do that. And I completely agree with Council Member Goodrich that the two-year review is certainly more appropriate than a two-year sunset. Mm-hmm. 2 years goes by awfully fast in this world. And I want to ask Yori, I can't recall, did the commission recommend a sunset or a review? I don't recall. I know you're recommending review. What was the commission?
The chapters themselves do not have any reference to floor area ratio any longer. So the adopted ordinance has nothing in it mentioning floor area ratio. The ordinance itself, though, says we're going to review for 2 years, and if at that time, more or less, council determines that the best way to go is floor area ratio, we'll go that way. If they determine it's another way, we'll go that way.
Okay. Thank you.
I'd just like to make one last comment. And I've said this before, but I really appreciate the fact that the Planning Commission and the council and staff have been so involved in this process. There's citizens out there with concerns. There's been a lot of people who have worked a lot of years to see the redevelopment of downtown Ferndale, and it's refreshing to have the city council be willing to sit and become a part of the whole process and listen to a citizen who has some concerns. And it's something that hasn't always been in the city of Ferndale, and it's refreshing that it is here. So thank you.
Okay, anyone else from the audience who would like to come forward and speak? Anyone? Any takers? No? You're on your edge of your seat. You look like
Lamar. Lamar.
No? Sure? Oh, yeah. Yeah. We talked him into it. Welcome.
You get extra credit.
I need that extra credit. Lamar McKay, 6781 Ocean Road. I just want to say that we did talk to discuss this at the board meeting with the Ferndale Downtown Association, and we voted. And it was a unanimous decision that we all agreed that this should be eliminated or to your review. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Okay. Anyone else in the audience? Okay. Seeing none, Council, I saw the first hand up, I believe, out of my eye was Councilperson Malfezzi.
I'd like to move to approve Agenda Bill 11-09-008.
Well, I want to raise this one question. It's the only question I have. Is in 2 years, how do we measure success? Do we measure success that a whole bunch of old buildings have been torn down and one-story buildings, businesses have gone up, or we're hoping that the taller buildings are going to go? I'm just curious in 2 years.
That will be up to the council in 2 years.
2 years. What are we looking for in 2 years? That was
why not? I'll say it would be successful if we had one or two applications of redevelopment of downtown without any tall buildings or whatever, just redevelopment in the downtown core.
Okay, further discussion on the motion? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? Good job, Council. Well done. Well done. Okay, the next item is the sidewalk project and Moy Avenue, Second Avenue project, and our stand-in for our public works director. Are you going to present that? Oh, she is. Okay, you're just taking the comfortable chair to look good. Now, how is it that he gets your comfortable chair?
I don't know. I think that's malarkey, but
what kind of operation is that? Where's Suzanne? Speaking of discriminatory duties. Welcome, Katie Ratter.
Thank you. Good evening, Council. We're back again. Last Council meeting, you authorized the Public Works Director to award a bid up to $260,000. We received 7 bids for the sidewalk project, and the low bid was approximately $2,500 over that pre-authorized amount. Larry Brown Construction of Bellingham was the low bidder at $262,519.25. And so staff is recommending that you award that to Larry Brown for that amount plus then a measly 3.8% contingency. Normally we ask for 10. So the total amount that we're asking Council to award is for $272,519.25.
Councilperson Metzler?
So you're asking a smaller contingency than what we had before, so we sort of kind of end up in the same place, worst-case scenario.
Right. I did the math earlier, and I think, you know, with the 260 plus the 10%, you'd be at 286 or whatever. So
I'd like to move the adoption of Agenda Bill 1109009.
Second.
Second. Further discussion? Councilperson Goodrich?
A thought just popped into my head. it could be. Did, by us pre-approving a dollar amount, kind of give the builders the kind of thing, oh, they're going to go up to $160,000, so...
It's a chance we took.
I don't know. If the, you know, for future reference, I don't know if we want to do that again or not, or, you know, because this is the first time a bid has come back higher than
engineering bids. If Tiger, who also bidded one of the project, he could have come in at 258 and gotten it. No, the bids are still competitive.
Yeah.
I think the experience that we're finding is that bids are coming in higher.
That's correct. We're, you know, this time of year, generally, you know, the contractors are, you know, they're set for work for the year, so it's not usually as competitive this time of year as it would be earlier. It's been our experience that the bids are coming in slightly higher than they have been. The bid prices have been rising on average.
I think it should be noted and make you feel more comfortable that even though that she looks like a very beautiful and sweet person,
I don't think you'd want to sit across the table and try to up your bid price with Ms. Ratter across the table from you. That would not be a wise decision by any means. And I don't think any contractors would even think of doing that, anyone that know her. And that's a comment.
Thank you.
Councilperson Metzler.
You know, Councilmember Goodrich could be right, but I think the opposite could well be true as well, that this is where we expected them to be. This is what the city budget, this is what council approved. We have an upper threshold. I would think that contractors would be trying to get someone below that to get the bid. So,
well, it's a risk on their part, too. I mean, you know, you don't want to bid something so low that you can't stay in business to try to deliver it either. So, you know, it goes both ways, I guess.
Councilor Zimmerman?
Katie, along Malloy, I mean, this amount of money is going to take care of the sidewalk. It's going to be, what, 4 foot wide?
It's a 5 foot wide sidewalk.
5 foot wide sidewalk. Mm-hmm. Well, and there's going to be some undulations to it because of the way the contour of the land is.
Right.
Now, some of the property is, you know, it's going to be carved away. Is there any retention walls or those type of things? Or, I mean, that's what I was curious. I didn't see any, you know, survey marks, anything like that. It's just, here it is. Cut it. And, I mean, there's plenty of people along there that don't. Know if they know, well, they probably know what's coming now, but
right, and we're working on contacting folks. You know, before we move forward with contacting people, we want to make sure that, you know, the project's moving forward before you concern people.
I guess my point is cutting into some of the hillsides and stuff like that. I just wonder how that would be handled, Luis. So
that'd be the details of the project, and not on the bid cost.
The way the project's designed is that they establish a profile, the center line of the road, and they try to keep that grade elevation. And so, you know, the sidewalk project, it is just a sidewalk project. It's not a road project. It's not a, you know, drainage project. Reichart Nebe has done a good job of getting that to fit in. So, you know, you only have so much room within the right-of-way in order to make those grades work. You know, you either raise or lower the sidewalk and get things to fit. So
there's ditches. There's a few obstacles along that way. So.
Right.
Okay, motion before you. Any further discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries 6-0. Thank you, Katie.
Thank you.
I'm going to stop for a second. I have a question. It's been brought to my attention. I'm going to ask the high school students. Normally, we let you loose at 8 o'clock, but it was suggested to me by the police chief you have an hour and a half assignment, or is it whenever you decide to
leave? The question just came up.
Okay. Is traditionally you're told to stay here an hour and a half max, or is that before we usually like release you at 8 o'clock, stop the meeting regardless where it is, release you at 8. Oh, this was your one chance.
I know.
Okay.
Hour and a half.
Yeah, it looks like they're here to the end.
Yeah. Thing, you know.
Silence is going to stay already. Boy, you had a chance. We're going until 8 o'clock. We're having a great time. You'll remember this.
When do they go back to class and find out?
No way.
Okay.
Yeah, what happened?
What? Yes. Now.
Ready?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I didn't get the new one.
Yeah. Okay, discussion.
Did you have any said?
No, it's G.
Claims?
We have to change the budget.
We'll put it on.
Oh, my gosh. I think you got a new one.
Yes,
right. We published a new one.
If I could just clarify one.
Yes.
City Clerk, can you just clarify? We have an agenda that's published that does have in the consent agenda this claims.
Yes.
I have an old paper one.
You do.
Council got the new one. It's all good. Thank you.
Okay. Only the paper, only your hard copy packet is the old version.
Very good.
They've already been printed.
Yep.
And so that's already been printed. Take care.
Yes.
So our next one is the discussion on the equivalent water sewer connection fee ordinance.
Monthly budget amendment.
Oh, excuse me.
The G.
This will be quick. Monthly budget amendment now.
It can be very, also, very quick.
Very quick.
No.
Motion.
I motion. We approve it.
Second.
Moved and seconded. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed. OK.
Okay, motion carried. Okay, Mr. Burnett.
Because we had to award this contract for sidewalks before we did this.
All right, so we're coming before you tonight not for a vote, but more for direction, policy direction, before staff goes on down the road on this issue. For the last several years, the city has had a flat water and sewer connection fee that we've charged. I believe the line item on our uniform fee schedule is equivalent connection fee or single-family equivalent fee. Our codes state that we can charge an equivalent residential unit fee, and we just have not defined what that would mean. So what staff is bringing before you as a possible change or modification is filling in language that doesn't currently exist, that could exist. And I think that I'm getting at least one look of confusion from one of our council members. What we are proposing is, rather than have a flat water and sewer connection fee where a single-family residence pays exactly the same $11,000 plus or minus for their connections as Bellis Fair Mall would. If Bellis Fair Mall came into the city of Ferndale, they would pay $11,000 for their water and sewer connection fees. Now, that is an inequity that staff feels needs to be resolved. The argument that we have heard against doing something like this is that the monthly or bi-monthly billing cycles will start to capture the actual use of these different types of uses. Connection fees are similar to our traffic impact fees, where they are generally intended to go towards capacity system improvements for our water and sewer plant, whereas our monthly billing charges generally go to our maintenance and operations of our existing. So the connection fees are supposed to pay for any capacity increases that we might need to make now or into the future, whereas the monthly billing is just our day-to-day activities. Right now, with a flat $11,000 fee, we do not adequately reflect what the true use and the true impact of the system is. So with Bellis Fair Mall example again, or maybe we want to use Hempler's Hot Dogs might be a real-world example. Hempler's, a great Ferndale business, uses an awful lot of the city's water to put into their products. But they did not need to pay or would not need to pay a fee that was any different than what the single-family residences were. Even though if we had 100 Hempler's Hot Dogs, we would need to have a pretty significant capacity upgrade to serve all of them. So what we're proposing to do, very similar to what we did with our traffic impact fees, is to have a list of different uses and their relative water and sewer usage. That way we would be able to look and see new hardware stores coming in, and a hardware store uses approximately 0.2 residential equivalencies per 1,000 square feet, which means that all that they really have in a hardware store is a bathroom. And it's not used much except for by employees and the odd customer or two that come in. So they, if they were a smaller hardware store, would actually pay less than a single-family residence, same as a bookstore, same as some others. On the flip side, you have a restaurant, you have a car wash, which would pay more than the single-family equivalency. Identifying the single-family equivalency is very easy. We can look at the average gallons per day used by a single-family residence, and that becomes one. We can then extrapolate from that and see what a variety of other jurisdictions have done as far as the average use of these other uses. And then we can say, just as we did with a bookstore, that uses one-fifth of a single-family equivalency per 1,000 square feet. Similar to our traffic impact fees, we would provide the opportunity for the applicant to say, actually, I'm different. I'm using high efficiency. I'm doing this. We take these steps so that everybody takes showers together or something like that to use less water. seeing if everybody was listening.
She's, I think you're awake.
We do not, and then I'll turn it over for questions, we do not propose changing the base rate at this point. So people would still pay $11,000 if they're a single-family unit. As Mark mentioned earlier on in the conversation, in 2012 or 2013, we're going to be doing a rate analysis that could result in some changes as a result of this. But right now, we would just be looking for your direction. It's a complicated issue. That's why we wanted to bring it to you to get the looks now, so that if we bring it back to you in a couple of weeks for a hearing, we're going to get more smiles.
Councilperson Goodrich, I'll just go in order. Councilperson Goodrich, much later than Hanson.
I kind of like the idea, but the only thing that kind of got me was the tying it to the square footage of the building. Let's use Ace Hardware, for example. Okay, yeah, he, you know, is 0.2, but let's say, you know, his store was twice as big, but he really, because he wanted to carry more products, but he doesn't, doesn't change his one restroom. Now he's paying twice as much for his connection fee just because his business is twice as big, not the fact that he put in twice as many restrooms. So I have a kind of a concern with tying it to square footage. I can see Hempler's versus Ace Hardware maybe doing a difference, but I don't know how else you would do it. But I just don't see it equitable on the square footage.
There are two or three additional ways that we can do it. And, again, similar to traffic, where they have rates based on employees, based on square footage, it would be similar to this, where we could say, okay, you can use an alternate measurement where it's 1,000 square feet or based on employees. So if they can demonstrate to us that because they carry more product, the square footage measurement isn't appropriate, we would also or instead be able to calculate based on their employees on the peak hour shift or something
could
like that.
Could it be tied to meter size like we did something? What was it we tied to, you know, if they put in a one-inch meter, that their rate is this, but if they put in a four-inch meter, then their connection fee would be based on, in theory, if they're putting in a bigger meter, therefore their water usage would be
That is another direction, and it is another alternative. That's what the city of Bellingham uses, is based on meter size. So whereas we have really infinite number of possibilities, Bellingham has 10 possibilities. If you're on a 10-inch meter, you pay $900,000. Done. If you're on an 8-inch, you pay $400,000. Done. That way, it's much more, I guess, straightforward. You fit into these boxes.
Because that gives you a better, more accurate idea of the usage of a building, because if they're going to put in a big meter, chances are they're going to be using a lot more water. Therefore, they'd have a bigger impact on our system, because of just the flow rate, you know, through a 4-inch versus or whatever size meter. So it seems like tying it to a meter size would be more equitable and easier to calculate than trying to figure out by usage and square footage of a building.
It would certainly, and then I'll turn it over to the city administrator, certainly be easier to calculate. Maybe not. Certainly be easier to calculate, but it wouldn't be as, precise as what we're looking for.
Yeah, there's always a trade-off between complexity and equity. Many of the places I've been at before had fairly complex, like with restaurants, it was number of seats, or laundromats, it was a number of laundry units. So you can really get more precise when you talk about particular users. It could be that the pet stores and the groceries, I mean not the grocery stores, but the hardware stores of the world, perhaps square footage is not necessarily an indication, but you could do it by number of fixtures in the. So it really depends on how you want to slice and dice it. The good thing about these charts is that they're used all across the country, and there's usually standards by which you can go. And so you can modify them, and if something isn't on the list, you can then add it in as they come in the door. And as our community development director noted, not unlike the traffic mitigation fees, where if a proponent says, I'm different, I'll do my own traffic study, someone can say, I'm different, I'm going to use ultra-low flow, or I'm only going to have, you know, one facility. So there are ways for them, through their practices or the design of their facility, to lessen the impact and not go straight off the chart. So you it depends on how complicated you want to get.
Make it quick. I have council people who want to talk.
Okay. Ms. Ratter just pointed out to me that unlike traffic impact fees, which measure the peak hour, 4 to 6, one of the things that we're looking at is gallons per day, the overall average. So whereas with a meter size, you might be able to get by with a 1-inch meter for 23 hours a day, maybe you have a peak where you're up at a 4-inch. So do we want to measure them 4-inch meter at its peak? She also pointed out that in the city of Ferndale, unlike Bellingham, which has large industrial facilities right now, we really only have 4 meter sizes, and of those 4, really only 2 or 3 are really used. So the use of meter sizes in Ferndale isn't as varied as Bellingham.
Jesperson, Mutchler, Hansen, then to Zimmerman.
Yeah, first of all, I want to just comment on something that Councilmember Goodrich said about the size of a building wouldn't necessarily have an impact. I would think, like, if an Ace Hardware doubled their size, they're probably going to need more employees. Those employees will probably work longer and probably have to be there longer using the facility. So I think that the square footage does make sense. However, I like the meter size. If we had the 10 meter sizes, because precision is kind of in the eye of the beholder. Even with homes, I have a 6-bedroom home with 4 bathrooms, and I have to have larger all sorts of things for that. That's a lot different than the person who has a 1-bedroom home, but it's the same fee. So we do have the disparity. We can't be that precise. I wanted to ask you the traffic impact fees, the counting of the traffic at peak hours. There's a formula for that. It's pretty established. It's there. We can look it up. I called it the Bible. You mm-hmm. called it something else. Mm-hmm. Is there something similar? Because you mentioned checking other cities out.
Yeah, it's called a meter.
Yeah. But we don't know until they – this is something we charge before they get in and start doing it.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Correct.
So – which is why I lean, if we could do more meters, but it sounds like we're not like Bellingham, we're only using 2 or 3.
There is no Bible where the
that seems to be your can of worms. You're going to have to develop all this stuff.
Yeah.
You would, and we have. The thing is, the water use or sewer use varies so much here compared to Phoenix, compared to Boston, compared to Miami.
And water and sewer are different.
And water and sewer are different.
Not the same.
Traffic isn't as different. However, the ratios are really, really similar.
Agreed.
From jurisdiction to jurisdiction. So whereas the base rate might vary widely, you generally see that a shoe store will always use 3 times as much as a single-family residence. Doesn't matter where it is. It just happens to be. You'll see that the different ratios.
I understand,
make sense.
But we want things to be easy for staff. We've mm-hmm. had this discussion mm-hmm. about lean, mm-hmm. and I read the thing. I read your arguments against the meters, and I thought they weren't very good. I liked the meters until Katie came forward, and I thought, what's going to be easy for the staff? It's the meter deal. But if it's only 2 or 3 different categories, it doesn't help us out. So, if you think you can handle this as a staff, going through all these different scenarios.
This would actually be fairly easy to calculate. The other thing that would help, too, is there are a variety of uses that would actually see a discount in their rates based on this. Irregardless of what the base rate is, if you happen to have, again, the bookstore that really uses no water or sewer, it's going to pay less than it does right now, which is an advantage, especially because a lot of those uses are kind of downtown-type uses that we're looking for, with the exception of restaurants. This is doable, very doable, but it is a policy question.
But as a principle, I like the idea. I think it's fair because they do bring the impact to the infrastructure that we have to build.
Yeah, before we go on, I just want to say, thank you for addressing the policy, because really what we're asking for is, do you like the concept of usage-based rather than just a flat fee? And the details hopefully can be worked.
Councilperson Hansen?
Well, they've already been worked out. I've been on the council long enough. I don't know whether that's fortunate or unfortunate. But about 10 years ago, we had this very discussion. We voted to make, at that time, what was in front of us was, instead of based on single-family equivalents, because at that time, that's how we determined what you would pay for water and sewer. And as planning directors and public works directors have changed, the policy has changed, but it has never been changed by the council. We had a system when I came on the council where single-family equivalents were determined by an estimate when the application came in and then confirmed by actual water usage. So if they went, and I'm going to speak to Hempers in a second because they were special, but when someone came in with a laundromat, for example, and it wanted to build a laundromat, and there was a big hue and cry because we were going to charge them 20 single-family equivalents because that was the estimated water that they would use. Then a year later, they were going to be reevaluated, and they would either be charged additional dollars at that point or given a refund through their rate structure. That's already in place somewhere in our code. And Yuri's nodding.
Yes, knows. You're correct.
I've talked to him about that before. Now comes Hempler's. And what came in front of the council at that point was Hempler's is going to have 30 single-family equivalents or 15, or I don't remember what the number was, but it was something, you know, and Hempler's said, wait a minute. Means we're going to pay this humongous bill to start with. Is there any other way it can be done? And I remember distinctly, it was Roland Signet that brought it forward, that let's charge Hempler's or give them an opportunity, their choice, not ours, their choice. You can either pay the 15 or 20 single-family equivalents up front, and then you pay the same rate for water that everybody else pays, or you can pay one single-family equivalent, but we will jack your water rate up. At that time, it was 80 cents per 100. I don't know why that sticks in my mind, but it was 80 cents, and it was going to go on, and you will pay that forever. Now, Mark, are we charging him for that?
Absolutely. There's about 20 others just like it. About 20 customers we charge this connection fee every 2 months based
on really?
80 cents.
Yes.
Because remember, they got a discount with the really heavy usage, too.
My point is that we already have some things in place, and I know where we're going on this. I was hoping that we hadn't dropped this, but apparently, as someone comes in and applies today, they're getting single-family equivalent. One, we're not charging them based on what we estimate their usage is going to be. Is that correct?
That is correct.
I think we did one per building on Ferndale Station.
Like we did one.
Well, it's another variation.
So really what we're saying is we need to go back and revisit what we already have in place.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, how difficult is it to charge those bigger, larger businesses? Because it would seem to me that if you came to me and said, look, we're going to charge you $100,000 for your water up front, or $200,000, or here's an alternative to pay it off, and what we did is we pegged that fee to pay it off in 20 years. But it doesn't stop after 20 years. It continues on out.
Yeah, I don't see any sunset.
There's no sunset, no. But Hempler's chose, that's one of them, that chose to pay on a bi-monthly a little bit as opposed to that massive upfront cost. So just
okay, before we move on to other questions, I'm going to do a 5-minute adjournment. We'll get the students out of here. So the students, you can line up and sign your sheets. And
for 80
cents,
that's the cost for 1 week.
It's 80 cents per unit of water.
100 feet.
So now what if
per unit of water. A unit is 100 cubic feet. Yeah.
So that's the cost of one. We cover that in one sausage.
I understand that, but do you realize Hempler's bill is almost $12,000 every 2 months? It's right behind Hagen's in terms of the largest water unit.
Well, that is, our sales capability becomes something different.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, the new hot dog place by the thing.
Yeah, well, and they have, because Hempler's has, in the meantime, sold.
But if somebody else
and the new owner came in and said, wait a minute, why don't you sell it?
Yeah, and it's a new business. Yeah.
And permission.
Okay, I think they got direction.
Well, I think
what he's proposing is we bring down the staple of that because if we're only charging larger than store, a Bella standard, just one hookup.
Yes, sir. So this says in 82 this was put in place, 1982. This originally said, and then I don't know if you read that or not. The EUR requirement was first put in place in 1982, and while there is anecdotal evidence that it was actually implemented, it has now been replaced by a flat water sewer.
But it did come in front of the
council.
And then they woke up and said, what's this personal bill connection charge?
$20,000 total. What's this thing?
You want to hear that. Yeah, that's what council wants to hear.
Well, he came in the other day. He's an old guy. Oh, yes. He's a lot of his product.
Everything's
got a high blood pressure.
I think it's a good idea.
A lot of these
One of the numbers here that probably along with talking about schools.
How is that? Okay.
Schools are doing well.
I can't imagine. Complex as a single family.
That's right. So there we go. But the front building is office. The front building is office and a restaurant. That's right. Back building is condo.
Otherwise,
when our condo complex, we're all back at a whole bank of water meters in front of my place.
That's typically on condo. The way they do it. Whereas multifamily apartment complex.
Bless you.
Okay, I'm going to go back in session and
hardware sales.
Councilperson Hanson, you were done. So next up was Councilperson Zimmerman.
I just want to clarify that when you spoke, it was not a new business, but a new building that was a connection fee. When a business comes in, they don't have a connection fee if they're taking over the business. In this case, Ace Hardware took over the old Ferndale Drug, so there was no connection to be involved. So.
Yes, correct, but if... If a use change, that would have been like for like, but if you went from an accountant's office to a restaurant, they would pay the difference in the fees.
Okay.
Councilperson Ingram was next.
Yori, I'm just curious here. If I'm correct, commercial buildings built currently... pretty much anywhere are required to have fire suppression sprinkler systems.
Yes.
How do we handle an 8-inch standpipe for fire flow in our connection fees? I mean, God forbid that ever has to be used, but if it does go off, there's one gargantuan amount of water going through that standpipe, and they're not metered.
No, we do not charge a separate fee for those. I noticed that Bellingham charges a separate connection fee for their landscaping. We don't have that either. So
we just treat it like a fire hydrant.
I believe that's the case. I don't think that we
metered water.
For their sprinkler system.
For fire sprinklers.
Are you asking if it's metered or not?
metered. It's not metered, no.
It's not metered.
No, I know that.
Just like a fire hydrant.
So we just consider it a fire hydrant. Okay. Thanks.
The fire hydrant just connects to it. That's what they do. They connect to the sprinkler system.
Did I miss Kesperson Mutzer? Were you in there? Or, okay. Kesperson Goodrich.
You said that the building was based off of 1,000 square feet?
That's just a round number, yes.
So yeah, if you had 0.2 times 1,000 at a 10,000 square feet, now that's two units.
Correct, yes.
So now their fee is double what they would have paid before. You said that they would get a break, but a 10,000 square foot building based off of your little scenario, 0.2, is now going to pay two units.
Correct, in that scenario.
So, so now all of a sudden, I see this, when you're going off of square footages, this is a big increase in fees to a developer.
If you had a 10,000 square foot bookstore, for instance, then yes. But if you had what's probably more likely, like a 1,000 or 2,000 square foot.
Well, what's a Barnes & Noble over there?
They're bankrupt.
No, that's Borders.
They're saying that.
They'll be next.
Yeah.
Call Kendall now.
For the stores that would be large size such as that, then they would see a cost increase. But for the smaller stores, the 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 square foot stores, they would likely see a decrease. Multifamily would likely see a decrease. But yes, certainly larger stores, especially some of those box stores.
Would Ace, if Ace was brand new, would he have to pay more?
If Ace was brand new, yes, I'm sure that he would have had to pay more. The principle here is that right now the single family residences are subsidizing the impacts of those larger uses because they are paying more. Than their share, basically, in order for these other uses to potentially pay less.
That takes me to that question. Where did that impact fee dollar amount come from?
Rate study. We do water sewer rate studies periodically, and the combination of bi-monthly billing rates for use and connection fee revenue.
No, but we're talking about connection fee. I mean, where did that $11,000 or whatever we charge, how did that dollar amount get derived? Was it just
rate study? Same answer.
Yeah, it's supported by the capital improvement plan. But if you remember some of the conversations we've had in the past about water and sewer rates versus connection fees, theoretically or technically, or in a preferred sense, connection fees would simply pay for your capital improvements. You wouldn't use your connection fees to pay for your daily operations. Ideally, your rates would pay for your operations. That's an ideal situation, which in the real life rarely can occur. So here, not unlike many places, we've somewhat conjoined our connection fees and rate fees to the extent that if we wanted rates to just pay for operations, we would have to raise water and sewer rates considerably. And that way we could take all the connection fees and purely put them over to the side to pay for future capital needs. We've somewhat blended those two together. So not unlike the situation with our, again, referring back to our traffic impact fees, where we said we could have a traffic impact fee up here if we wanted to pay for all of these things. The decision was to make it, and you can do that. You can make it a lower amount. You can't go higher than what the capital needs show, but you can certainly go less. So in this case, our capital connection fees have been a mathematical result of our future capital needs, tempered by the reality of our inability to separate connection fees and operation fees through rates. So and this goes back to the whole point that when you get these larger water users that come online, the future capital needs don't change. They just come much quicker. And when you have artificially low connection fees, those fiscal realities of needing to build water storage tanks or expanding water sewer plants hit you at a point where you've not been able to put off to the side connection fees, and you're forced in that case to either curtail development, which is extremely hard, or indebt yourself and therefore roll it into rates, and the ratepayers end up paying for the capital needs that perhaps your bigger users, if we had, like Yuri said, if we had 10 Hemplers or if we had 6 or 8 big box stores come in that were heavy water users, they would be using the equivalency of hundreds, maybe even thousands of homes in true usage amounts. So that's really the key here, is to try to recognize the fact that there are some businesses that their business model requires an extensive use of water and in some cases, sewer.
And we
I think, using that, the thing, though, is I'd hate to see us do something, like I said, that's tied to the square footage of a building, even though it's kind of use-related, because I don't see ACE doubling in size means that they're going to double their water usage. But yet the fee would double. So I'm kind of concerned with that idea. I see this as a way that our future retail development is going to end up paying a lot more for their connection. Yeah, if we want to lower the fees for houses, let's lower the fees for houses. And say, if you're building a house, you only pay $5,000 a connection fee, and then keep the other ones at $11,000 or come to a thing. But to base it off of square footage and say that they're going to get a lower fee, when in reality they'll probably end up paying twice as much or more than they do today, I don't think that's a valid statement to make.
Well, because the meter sizes, if we went for meter sizes, almost certainly something like ACE would pay more than they did if we were going based on meter sizes, because they have a larger meter, I'm assuming, than probably a single-family residence does. I don't know if that's the case. But there would be that presumption that those larger users, if we went to a meter size or something else, would pay more. I guess those are the three options, the flat rate, meter size, or this way.
Okay, before we go to the questions, and I'll go to Councilors Mutchler and Hansen, your objective here is to give a clear objective to staff. Seems completely clear to me. Councilperson Mutchler?
It's a good discussion still. Mr. Young, I do remember you telling us, or we discussed the fact that our impact fees are subsidizing our hookup fees are subsidizing our usage. Give us a maybe marking of approximately how much of our revenue needed to run the water sewer is coming from those hookups. Well, is it a significant amount or like a fraction?
I think we take all of our connection fees and use them in operations. I don't think we really take any connection fees and put them into a capital reserve.
We do not. Yeah, we do not.
That's good to know. I thought that we collect those hookup fees and we're not using those for infrastructure right now. We're paying for infrastructure in part out of rates and things like that. It's all very mixed.
Yeah.
So maybe that's philosophically another question for another day to consider. And then my last question.
No, it's actually very much part of the discussion.
Okay, I'll change it. I'm not right. Another question would be, the city really doesn't care who uses the water, whether it's a home. And let's say it takes 100 homes to be the equivalent of Bell's Fairs, whatever matches. The impact on our infrastructure is exactly the same. Whether it's 100 homes using a fixed amount of water or a Bellosphere using the same amount of water. In other words, what I'm trying to get to is I originally thought I liked the idea of the equivalence of a single-family unit and then multiplying it out as accurately as we can in terms of what the eventual water usage should be. But I thought maybe it doesn't need to be tit for tat. Maybe it doesn't have to be exact units. But the water, the impact on the infrastructure is exactly the same, regardless of whoever's using the water.
Not when you consider Bo help. I mean, not when you consider fire flow requirements, because you're gonna need that giant amount of water faster than that goes into large tanks.
Okay. Fire flow requirements will be a little bit different as far as where Chief Russell will allow the hydrants to be placed and the pump reports away from the hydrants to fill the buildings to run the sprinklers.
But don't they pay for that? Or doesn't a developer pay for that?
They do just install all these.
Yeah, so that doesn't cost us anything.
Well, like in my building, I have an actual pump on my fire system, so if the sprinkler goes off, I have a big old massive pump that kicks in to increase the flow.
Yeah, what does cost money?
Every fire is
We have to go flush those systems.
I didn't have a
mirror. I
didn't know where to look.
So that hydrant belongs to
the one person discussion. He's talking. Everybody else gets to be quiet.
I'll be working for 4 years.
Okay, were you done? Sorry. Everybody was
interrupting. So, yeah, so I'm sympathetic for what Brenda's saying. I don't want to clobber development and businesses, but what is their fair amount in terms of their impact on our infrastructure? Is it the same? Again, if the water usage is, if we can calculate the same water usage, 100 homes, this business, is it the same impact on our infrastructure pretty much? Or is it perhaps less with business? Or is it more?
Well, and that's the other thing that we have to keep in mind. Same as our traffic impact fees. If an applicant can say, we have the same equivalent size ACE elsewhere, or we have this or that, and we're going to be using less than what you believe, we can certainly look at that. Because that's the intent here, is to say if a single-family residence is one, and if it pays $5,000 for a fee, if you use half again as much water as a single-family residence, you should pay half again as much of a connection fee. This is one way to do that, to show these standard rates, and hopefully they are not beyond the pale of reason. If they are in individual circumstances, they can always demonstrate to the public works director, here's why we believe that we're going to be less. So always have that ability.
And I understand, agree with you completely, but I don't think that you – maybe I didn't ask the question very well. Is there a different impact on the city's infrastructure, whether that water – if it's the same amount of water coming from a bunch of homes as that same amount of water coming from a business, is it roughly the same impact in what we have to do as a city?
You're kind of mixing things, though, because, like, say you've got one customer, and you've got all these, you've got one big pipe going to one customer. So you've got...
That's exactly what I'm referring to.
You've got the plant, and then you've got your
distribution
system.
Can we get you a microphone?
So if you've got one pipe and one customer, then you've got your plant, you've got your distribution system, you've got your endpoint, right? Okay. So if you're talking about a 100 home subdivision, correct me if I'm wrong, there's a larger distribution system associated with. So you're kind of mixing apples for oranges. You can't, for a 100 home subdivision, you've got a way bigger, for lack of a better term,
there
way
may be a
bigger
greater
distribution
impact
system. That then the city maintains,
right?
Versus one big pipe going
okay.
to one customer.
In that case, so it would be fair then to charge proportionally as much.
But then,
because the homeowners actually are getting the break. Then.
Yes, they are.
In your scenario, the homeowners would be subsidized by the big retail.
Well, that depends if you're mixing together your distribution system versus just, you know, the creation of the water itself. You know what I mean?
I'm getting it. Thank
you. Yeah.
Thank you. Vice President Hansen.
Well, and this goes back to something that Brent said about square footage. When he already started, one of the things that he mentioned is that square footage is one of the ways. But it's only one of the ways that a formula can be based. Meter size is another way that the formula could be based. Combination of square footage and meter size. Number of toilets mm-hmm. in the building certainly would have an impact. If you're talking about complexes that have bedrooms, then you go by the number of bedrooms. There are certainly other ways besides square footage that you can – I think square footage has got to be part of the component because there's going to be a certain amount of washing down of parking lots and water usage that's not traditional water usage. What I saw Yori fishing for here was not for us to decide tonight how that was going to be done, but do we support having a system, a formula, for determining what these larger water users is going to be. And at that point, then I guess we can fight about whether it's fair or unfair to all of the people that are involved.
And I think that I am getting some direction. You're not wanting the the ratios to look at these larger ones as a cash cow necessarily. You don't want to reverse the subsidization. You want it to be as equitable as possible. And that you can certainly make those policy decisions as far as the ratios where maybe we bring them back down where instead of 20 single-family units, maybe it's only 15. And that's a policy decision that I don't think development's going to argue if you're going to be charging them less than what you could or argue as much.
I think if you've got enough direction, we can probably say that this is a discussion that we've had and we can move on.
Close up, answer the question on water sewer connection fees. We looked here for 2011 on both water and sewer. If we wanted to segregate our connection fees, we have to raise water and sewer rates about 20%.
That's good to know.
Okay, very good discussion.
Yeah.
Very interesting. There we go. Okay, Mayor reports. Mayor has nothing to report. Council reports. You think? Councilman Ingram?
Well, obviously, we got back early. one of these days when you're going to be in the office, and I'll come in and tell you about the ride to Mexican Hat and the tour of the Valley of the Shadow of Death. You'll love it. Only another rider will enjoy that story.
Okay. Any council reports? Nothing report?
Oh, canceled for this year.
Okay, another council reports. Staff reports. Treasurer.
Nothing.
City administrator.
Nothing.
Planning.
Nothing.
Police chief.
Nothing.
City clerk. Public works. Council, I entertain a motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn.
Can I ask, Manuel, I was not able to get to the Fiesta Patrias. How did it turn out?
Where are you, Tom? Sorry.
State my name. Yeah. Manuel Reta, 2064 Main Street. It was very positive. I didn't hear no negative report whatsoever. It was kind of cold, but with everybody doing their thing, everything was positive. I mean, the men were taking care of the children. The women were actually being involved a lot of times in the events, which you rarely see sometimes. Police report on that, I guess it was okay. Even after the park there, we had the dads of the boys and girls club there. Everybody admired the building. Very positive, very good. And so overall, it's a very good event. So next year, I'm planning to have it 1 week before when it's warmer. So expect a bigger crowd, bigger.
It's 2 years in a row it's been cold there.
It was cold. Thank you.
Thank you.
Entertain a motion to adjourn.
I already made that motion.
Oh, okay. All okay. Favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
We're adjourned.
Yeah, I added one construction fund.
I can get rid of it.
I'm not going to get rid of it.